I'd like to call a meeting that the House Transportation Finance Division ordered. This evening, basically, what we're here for is to receive testimony based on what you think we need as far as transportation issues go for the state of Minnesota. Now, that deals with government transportation, MDOT, or counties, or cities, or towns, anything relating to transportation. And, of course, transportation includes transit, rail, basically air and ports and highways. So, any testimony that you have, we certainly are going to hope we can hear it all. That's the intention, that we should make some decisions if we need funding or if we don't need funding or if everybody's happy or whatever the situation is. So basically, to start out, certainly I want to welcome all the people that took that on to come, and I hope that it will be informational for you too. We will introduce ourselves just so you know the composition of the committee, the geographic composition basically, and I'll just start with the local, one of the locals. I don't know if he's a local representative,
but local. I'm a local. I'm Representative Doug Magnus. I live near Slayton, Minnesota, and thankfully it rained, so I got up the combine and got here because I farmed down there. And I'm very interested in the presentation when I talk about Slayton, Wisconsin, all about farming here right now.
I'm Representative Terry Morrow. I represent Nicollet County in the western part of Sidney County. I'm very interested in talking about transportation funding and especially Highway 14 and its freight study is something I've heard a great deal about. I think it'd be a great interest for all of us. Oh, I'll ask Highway 60, sure. I'll take you a minute. 14 answers.
I'm Kathy Bryant, and I represent the district that you're sitting in at the moment, and I want to welcome all of you to Mankato and Blue Earth County, and obviously this is a very critical issue for all of us, and I know many people sitting with us tonight, professionals, government officials, citizens, visitors, who are here because you care enough to invest your evening. And I thank you for coming, and we look forward to hearing your issues and concerns.
And I'm Bernie Leader. I come from northwestern Minnesota, way up near Canada and North Dakota.
And I'm Senator Catherine Sharon, and I'm just very grateful to the House and to the representatives here for letting me come this evening and listen to your concerns because we would share. I think this is a marvelous opportunity for me to hear them as I represent in the Senate, and so I'm delighted to be here and to be a guest of the House at the table here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm State Representative Frank Hornstein. I represent part of the southwest portion of the city of Minneapolis, and I also chair a subcommittee of this committee that deals with transportation policy and transit, so I'm interested in the whole realm of transportation issues, but I'm also interested in transit, and this isn't just a metro issue, and you know, we have provisions for rural transit in the transportation bill that was passed, and so I'm particularly interested in that issue. Folks have comments on that.
And I'm Representative Michael Nelson. I serve in the southern half of Brooklyn Park, which is in Hennepin County, and I'm glad to be here.
We have several other members we know we'll be here, and one of them just left off, so when she comes back in, we'll have her introduce herself. I'd also like to our staff person, Abby Mayhem, the committee administrator, and Susan Barr is legislative assistant, and Dan Kane is the researcher, I suppose. We're going to start this evening with a freight study from Mr. Wisconsin, from district engineer. And the reason we have a freight study right now, they just have completed a study, and he'll tell you more about it. But the freight study really has large implications dealing with us now as funding as far as bridges go and highways, and I think you all remember what's happened in the past month. And it's really emphasized the need to take a look at what's happening as far as roads and lengths and all that goes. And we appreciate you coming, Mr. Swanson. And we told him to cut it short because we're going to have a lot of complaints. Welcome to the meeting, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you very much. Would you like me to use the microphone, or would you like to hear me from here? I just want to make sure you can all hear me. It's fine. Okay, that's the main thing. So, I am Jim Swanson, district manager for the Department of Transportation. And I want to welcome all of you here and thank all of the legislators and representatives and senators for coming down here and being in southern Minnesota. We're very pleased to be here and talk about this tonight. Our presentation tonight is about freight movement in southern Minnesota, but it not only applies to the Department of Transportation, it very equally applies to all the counties, all the townships, and so it's very apropos for everybody sitting here to have a little piece of this thing that we've got going on here. We did a statewide freight study about a year and a half ago, and we looked at kind of the big emphasis of this freight in Minnesota, where it moves, how it moves, and where it comes and goes to. But as we look at our areas and the changes we've seen take place over the last 20 years, we've seen a tremendous difference in southern Minnesota as well as the other agricultural areas around the state. The west side, the southeast side, everybody with agriculture has had a dramatic change with all the ethanol plants going on, all the wind generation things happening, all the hogs, lots that have been producing hogs. And in case you don't know, we have in this particular district, I represent 13 geographical counties here in south central southwestern Minnesota. And in those 13 counties alone, we raise 5 million hogs a year. Now that's like the entire population of the state of Minnesota. Now can you imagine taking the entire state of Minnesota, all the population, feeding them, loading them on trucks, hauling them to the slaughterhouse, every year? I mean, put that in your mind here. We spend a lot of time talking about logs in the north, a lot of tourism in the north, and a lot of congestion in the metro area. I spent my first 20 years of my career working in the metro area. Did a little work in that bridge that fell down, just some guardrail work. But they built many bridges up there. And so I'm very familiar with that metro area too. We do have a lot of congestion in that area, and we do talk about it. One of the biggest congestion issues is about moving freight through that metro area. So that ties very closely to this, because a high percentage of freight that's generated out here also moves through the metro area. We have about 9 ethanol plants, 5 of them in operation, 4 of them presently being built as we speak. A new one. So in this district alone, we have a lot of things going on. To kind of put the presentation on tonight, and to use your time most wisely, I have Dave Christensen here, who's our expert. He's with our consultant SRF, and he will make the presentation for us because he can run through it, and then we'd be happy to take questions afterwards. So with that,
and Ms. Kirkmeister, we recognize we've got some time to explain, so we have a lot of testifiers. Appreciate it. One thing I forgot to announce for people that wanted to testify, if they're not on the list, is the sign-up sheet there, and there's also a form to fill out for testimony and sign-up sheet, and there's also another card in case you want to contact anyone after we have right back in the door. Back by the door. So excuse me, that's okay. I'll make that announcement.
Thank you very much. And I will turn it over to Dave Christensen. Dave?
Thank you, Jim. We started the study just about exactly a year ago. MnDOT, as Jim said, had done a statewide freight study in 2005 that looked at everything that moved in and out of the state, what the commodities were, what the value was, but it just gave an overall picture of how much business there is in the state. It did not address what happens on the local roads and how the system actually works at business level. So what we did in District 7 is MnDOT chartered a study to look specifically at what happens here in this district. And so we put it in the context of the big study, but took it down to where the rubber meets the road. And one of the things we did differently here in District 7 is we involved local businesses across the area, from all 13 counties, from every commodity group and every business group, so that we got a good feedback from local business instead of just going through the academics at the University of Minnesota and University of Iowa and rehashing old research. We also looked at how do we handle the problems and the issues that we identified when we did this. know where District 7 is. Jim said the 13 counties in the southwest corner of the state. The metro area is just to the northeast, and it is the biggest trading partner with this group. But of course, in District 7, with the agricultural base especially, materials move out of here in all directions, worldwide. The study area, we looked at the infrastructure. We have the airport system, the regular main airport, Mankato, for the region, several smaller feeder airports. We've got a good network of interstates, state highways. The local roads you see here are 10-ton network roads, mostly county roads and Kasaa highways that feed all the major trunk highways. When a semi leaves the farm, the first place they're trying to get to is one of these heavy-duty roads. Some of these roads, as you can easily see, there's a lot of gaps in a lot of the counties, even though this entire area is heavily cultivated and creating traffic every day of the year. You also have a good network of railroads in here. You haven't lost as many railroads as most parts of the country. We've got a Colonial Pipeline moving through and a lot of other things that move freight around the area. Minnesota's Corn Belt is where we are in the center of. And that also defines what happens in the district. With ethanol, with soybeans, and biodiesel, and just the whole agricultural area. What we are going to see here is what is represented for the entire Corn Belt and the entire Midwest. We have steady and significant growth, partly because of the growth in the agricultural yields, just because even though the population is steady, the businesses are still growing here. Responsive management, that comes back to the fact that when you've got small businesses and farmers as the base of your industry and your economy out here, the ones that have survived the last 30 years are the best businessmen that we have in the country. And they're turning out really productive activities on the farm and businesses. Technology, we're at the forefront in genetics, with plants, with animals, with biosciences and communications down here, and it's central to the economy of Minnesota. The impacts of D7, energy costs and biofuels, like I mentioned, ethanol, what we're going to talk about a great deal here. Globalization and marketplace. One of the companies we talked to, Scott Equipment and New Freight, they produce several truckloads of heavy-duty feed mill equipment every day. Half of what they produce is sold overseas, not even in the U.S. And that's a business that's been there for 30 years, two plants, 350 employees, totally invisible if you pass it on the highway going into New Freight. But there's hundreds of these plants and businesses all over. Market economy, we are not tied down here to the public sector and government down there. Most of what happens is responsive to market prices and business pressures. Labor and technology. Labor is, of course, a factor down here. There's always a shortage of it on the farm and small businesses. The young people who are getting here go to Mankato State or go out of the area for education and leave because of lack of opportunity, so it's always a pressure. The technology is taking a lot of place there. Truck size and weight, we'll talk about that. Public and private projects to keep those trucks moving and to help develop some of what we're going to talk about. Unit and shuttle trains. Shuttle trains here in this area have defined what has happened with the grain business over the last 20 years. Now we're going to see a shift away from that. But those shuttle trains, by definition, are 110-car trains that go to one elevator. That elevator collects grain from as much as 75 miles away, loads that train in 18 hours. It goes nonstop as one unit to a final destination. Most of the destinations are either the ocean ports in New Orleans or Houston or Los Angeles or the Central Valley in California or the poultry farms in the Ozarks. And then intermodalism. One of the things that we're seeing happen instead of trucking, we're seeing international goods, which is more and more coming out of D7, going overseas in marine containers. Marine containers nowadays move on the railroads at 60 miles an hour in double-stack trains like this. One train a mile long holds 300 containers, 8,000 tons of freight, gets from here to the coast of Los Angeles in 3 days. But that is a major corridor player, and we don't have good access to that in District 7. So local businesses, private businesses are starting to impact that now. The containers you see up there in the upper left-hand corner are specialized containers loaded with distiller dried grains and export grains, moving on special chassis and rolling on railroad tracks because of the chassis modification. They're taken into the Twin Cities, loaded from those chassis onto these double-stack trains, and therefore they get to the international market. That's the exception to the rule. Long-term continuing trends, we see farms, the acres of land being cultivated here are not changing. The number of farmers out there, labor involved, are pretty much the same. The farms are getting bigger, they're consolidating. One farmer is managing more and more acres. Some of the people we talked to are running 4,000, 4,500, 5,000 acres. Increasing yields, we'll see what happens to the yields. It's real eye-opener. Intensive cultivation, we know that every acre of land that can be used here is being used, but now with the switch to ethanol, corn is coming up, and we're using more and more of that land more productively. What's happening in freight around the country, 70% of the freight, or 71% growth in freight is expected by the Federal Highway Commission by 2020 in this area alone. Ethanol expansion is what's happening. Cellulosic ethanol, in 5 years we may have a feedstock to these ethanol plants out here that will increase production in 2 to 5% more. I talked about shuttle train elevators and oil and natural gas supplies. If we didn't have gasoline getting more expensive, ethanol wouldn't be happening. But it's $3 a gallon, it's very profitable, and it's only going to grow. Corn production, D7 has a third of what Minnesota produces, a third of the soybeans, half of the hogs. Like Jim mentioned, 10 million hogs produced every year in Minnesota. Half of Minnesota's ethanol, Minnesota is the third largest state in the country producing ethanol, just behind Iowa and Nebraska. And then we produce a lot of minerals here. The commodities, if you look just at 2 points here, farm products and food products make up half of the 27 million tons of products that are produced here every year in D7. Corn yields, one of the things that's fairly invisible and unknown by the general public is that back in 1970, the average corn yield was about 80 to 85 bushels per acre. Now we're looking at an average corn yield in this district of 185 bushels an acre. Same acreage, more than twice the production. Soybeans, same way. We're moving from 30 bushels an acre up to approaching 60 bushels an acre. That means more trucks, more tonnage on the roads, and more product being produced. Hogs. Again, we went from 1 million hogs now to 5 million hogs in this district. What's happening with equipment size? To move all this increased production on the roads, we're going to mega combines, grain hoppers. This is a 600 bushel hopper. They get up to 100 or 1,000 bushels, carrying an axle load of almost twice what an over-the-road truck can carry. And some of the time, those will be rolling on local highways. One of the things that's happened in just the last 5 years, farmers in the majority have moved from 2 and 3 axle trucks to 5 axle semis as the main choice and convenience. So you've got used trucks and new trucks on almost every farm down near D7, in some cases 2 and 3 in the farmyard. 60% of all the product moving to market now this year is going to be moved in farm-owned semis. You've got bigger farm equipment, you've got infrastructure limits. Some of the roads that we're looking at, and even the railroads, we're moving from 100-ton cars to 125-ton cars. Truck weights, MnDOT is thinking about increasing the load limits, but again, it's an issue of bridges now. But because of bridges, local roads, and rail branches that were designed and built in the 1950s and 60s, we've now got twice as much traffic and four times the tonnage moving over what they were designed for. The ethanol plant. Jim mentioned that we've got a lot of plants here, more buildings. This is what it looks like in the United States. This was a year ago, over 110 plants. You can see they're located right in the Corn Belt. This is where all the action is happening. Corn ethanol plants, one of the things I want to point out here, every ethanol plant sits on a major highway and a major railroad. Because even though all the corn comes in by truck, only a part of it leaves by truck. Byproducts, feed, GS, and ethanol, most of the ethanol is moving by rail car now. The average plant out there, a 40 million gallon plant, has 70 trucks coming in every day and 7 to 10 rail cars leaving every day. It collects grain from a 30 mile radius. The next generation of plant, instead of 40 million gallons a year, the plants that are being built as we speak right now that are coming online this year are 100 million gallons a year, 2.5 times the size. Means some of these plants are shipping entire car train loads of ethanol every week. Plant capacity, thing here is the plant capacity just in District 7 is doubling in the last 2 years. And the crop yield is going into a third of the corn crop is going to ethanol production this year. The national average is expected in 2 to 3 years to go up to 40 to 45% everywhere in the corn belt. Corn prices, looking about where the corn prices are right now, approaching $4 for a bushel of corn. And we're talking just before this is up to $9 or $10 for soybean. Again, because of market pressures caused by ethanol, and also the fact that you see nothing happened here until this last year. Corn has always been in surplus. We've had 3 or 4 years of corn sitting on the ground in the elevators. We're finally at the point where that surplus is gone. Now corn prices are reacting directly to the marketplace. An ethanol plant, you put 10 tons of corn in the ethanol plant, you get 3 tons of ethanol out of it. Almost 1,000 gallons of ethanol going into your tank. Every bushel of corn creates 2.5 gallons of ethanol. Equal amount of distilled dried grains comes out. That's good cattle feed. It's halfway between cornmeal and soybean meal in terms of protein content. And then CO2 is a byproduct a lot of it used in industrial processes. What does this do to Minnesota? In District 7 alone, you've got almost $1 billion of income last year generated by higher corn and soybean prices and the value added on ethanol. For Minnesota, you're talking $3 billion in effect on the economy last year. What's happening to freight? In the old days, back in the 60s, 50s, you had grain, dairy products, beef being produced on the farm, went straight to market. Pretty simple process. People haul to the railhead and it moves out to the processing plants. Nowadays, because of fuel plants out there and byproducts coming out of fuel plants, some of these being used back on the farm, the silver dried grains going to the pig farrowing operations, some of the soybean processing plants being recycled, you've got a network of freight hauling that's almost double the mileage and the number of trucks out there for even if you only have the same tonnage. What's the response to this high gasoline prices? Crop rotation is going from soybeans and corn equally to corn on corn because of the value of corn per acre. That means that there's a 55% growth in production that we're looking at in just the next several years. Genetics and management, we're looking at probably 15-25% growth just because over the last 30 years we've seen that much increase just because of crop genetics and good farm management. That means that by 2030, we're possibly going to see as much as a 230% increase over days and numbers and tonnage of trucks on our local roads. That can increase even more when we get to cellulosic feedstock. Like I say, every square mile of farm before this increase was created 80 semi-trucks equivalent. That's growing to 160 trucks. And that's about what the curve looks like. And that's all going on local roads because it's the first network coming off the farm. What are we doing? Opportunities. We need to preserve rail capacity because railroads move a lot of this material. Not only grains on shuttle trains, but DDGS and containers and hopper cars, and of course the ethanol. Problem is, it's a private infrastructure paid for by the railroads. But MnDOT is working on keeping some of these short lines in operation instead of letting it be abandoned. Efficient trucking. We've got big semis being used by 60% of the farmers out there now. The road designs haven't increased, or the road geometries and intersections and safety. We're still looking at old designs and capacity. Safety and security. Looking at a homeland security route, ethanol is a hazardous material. Just like gasoline or diesel fuel, it can burn. Of course, it's a lot cooler burning and a lot safer than gasoline. So if you have a rail accident nearby or a truck turning over, you don't have to worry about an explosion that's going to wipe everything away for a half mile. But the problem is, in keeping that safe, farming and agriculture and these plants are dispersed networks. You've got to be able to spend the money and keep people aware of what's going on everywhere that you're driving trucks. Intermodal growth, we don't have the local access we need to reach those international markets efficiently. Accident reduction, we're working on more grade crossing safety and energy efficiency. If we don't maintain the mix of modes, that means keep the barges running, keep the rails running, everything else. If we hadn't moved everything by truck, you'd have twice the number of trucks running out there at 4 times the fuel usage. Natural significance. Energy and agriculture is a key to our security in this nation these days. We need to keep as much of that local as possible. Integrated freight network, I talked about the 10-ton networks, the county roads, all the way up to the interstates. We are not building capacity we need, and we have gridlocks everywhere that those roads come together. That also includes the railroad structures. The railroads are pouring three-quarters of their profits back into infrastructure everywhere, only on main lines and as major terminals. That's leaving the capacity at those terminals still gridlocked because of the huge growth in traffic. Union Pacific in the last 5 years saw 280% growth in containers moving over their system. And they can't build tracks fast enough to handle it. But we're not keeping up. Rural infrastructure, again, we don't have the resources at the local level to rebuild the bridges, upgrade the roads, increase the width of shoulders, the depth of the asphalt on the roads, the capacity of the bridges, and safety and energy conservation. All this is served by keeping a good, healthy rural environment and a good transportation network. What are we finding? We're recommending in this study that we preserve the local freight network as much as possible. But that comes down to one thing, funding. We need to recognize the characteristics of modern freight farm vehicles, the tonnage of freight that's moving, the size of the vehicles that are being used both privately and by commercial carriers, the size of the railroad cars. It all plays a part, and it's all been ignored for the last 20 to 30 years. And then upgrade freight-related and traffic load data. We don't know how much our roads can carry, and we don't know how many trucks actually are moving on a day-to-day basis over a given mile of road. That has to be something that MnDOT and the county step up to as far as data collection in the future. Interagency planning. The governor's called together an ethanol task force. We need the same kind of task force working between DNR and PCA and MnDOT and all the other agencies to work on these problems of freight transportation if we want to keep our businesses healthy. It all comes down to the competitiveness of Minnesota. And then involving our local businesses and stakeholders. We found so much information just by talking to the locals here that it was unbelievable. Shouldn't have been any news. But it was something that was really created a paradigm shift in how we're going to approach this in the future. And then facilitate intermodal access. We've got to look at ways not only to use the railroads better, but to get more traffic onto the railroads where they have capacity. The Union Pacific line between Omaha and the Twin Cities operates 4 trains a day. They could be running 30 trains a day on the capacity they have on that line if there was enough freight to feed it. And think how many trucks that would take off the road. So, that's my presentation. If you have any questions, I'll be
thank you. I'm sure we have some questions. Sorry we haven't told you. You did a good job.
No problem.
Keeping way ahead of things, too. And I think the thing that's of interest to us is the fact that the trucks are getting bigger and heavier, and that's the concern that we have, especially in the road and also the bridges. But we have, before I take some questions, Jim, we have a couple of representatives came back in. If you want to introduce yourself, please.
I'm Linda Falcom. I represent District 63B, which is Richfield and Houston. Representative Shelley Medora from Alabama, Burnsville.
Representative Melissa Hartman from Brooklyn Park in Coon Rapids.
Thank you. I think we may have another member that's new, but I think he's been here. Jim, if there are questions from the
Well, again, I just want to say thank you again to all of you who came. And again, as I started out saying, the reason we wanted to make this presentation tonight is we know that it's so obvious people can see the congestion in the Twin Cities. It's so obvious we can see all the things and the number of people and tourism that we have going to northern Minnesota. But in the rural communities, people haven't realized that over the last 20 years, we've seen crop production double. So there's tremendous amounts of more trucks out here. Everyone sitting here in the audience keeps saying, why is there so many trucks around today? It's because farmers are all buying trucks. That's the movement of choice. That's the movement by trucks. So there's semis all over. And that goes all the way from our trunk highways to the county system, right down to the township system, right to those people's farms. That's what's so important for all the county commissioners, the township officials. All of them have a stake in this thing because that is what is meant in the agricultural area here. Is it affects everybody out here, and it's a booming industry. We used to talk about, we saw the population is dropping out here. Well, I can tell you the traffic isn't dropping. The congestion of the freight isn't dropping. The freight is increasing every day. and the movement of it. So that's where we're at. Thank you very much.
I think Representative Hornstein manifest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess I would be interested in your presentation. You talked about the 1950s design of roads. We heard in Wilmer about the lack of shoulders, for example. Could you give me a couple of examples of what you mean by the 1950s
design? One thing, we've got the width of roads is the same as it was back in the 1950s. When you come to an intersection, there's no turn lanes, there's no climbing lanes on hills, there's no queuing lanes at new ethanol plants, for instance. When you come up to that intersection with a two- or three-axle solid frame truck that's only 25 feet long, you've got no trouble getting around. When you come up to a fully loaded semi, first you've got braking and acceleration characteristics that slow down all the rest of the traffic, and then you can't get around the corner in some cases. You come up to an ethanol plant, along Highway 60, what we call Ethanol Alley, you've got Highway 60 right alongside the railroad tracks, only 20 feet away. And if you want to get into some of those ethanol plants, you've got to pull off that high-speed highway, across the grade crossing that's elevated above the tracks, and back down into the ethanol plant. Now, if there's any lineup behind the scales, you're going to end up with your semi, especially if it's farm-driven and the farmer doesn't know enough to keep out of the way of the railroad train the first time he does this, you know, just after he bought his truck. You're going to have them stuck on that railroad crossing. Worse yet, as soon as you have a backup, which happens all the time with these plants, if anything slows down, you've got the queue out onto the traffic lane on Highway 60 with people coming up behind it 70 miles an hour. That's what happens with bad geometry and weak roads and everything else.
I'm giving an example of that. I was just down at the Hare Lake plant and met with them here in the spring. And one of the guys who's the president of that association is also a county commissioner. And he was asking me why. He said, I have trouble just turning off the roadway with my semi now. He said, why is that happening? He said, we can't have these roads like this. And our roads today, our county roads, are designed that if you're going to turn off on them from a highway, you have to overcrowd and actually be in the other lane, because there's never been that much traffic that it didn't have that opening where it could make that turn. In today's world, we need that full width of those roads. And those are some of the designs that have to be changed. We were building Highway 14 out here by Janesville, and we had our very modern design. And immediately when they told us that an ethanol plant was going in out here, we immediately stepped back and said, if an ethanol plant is going at that location, we need to add acceleration lanes, add longer turn lanes, we need to widen the median so we got storage for trucks, and we did all those things just knowing that was going to come, and now it's being built over there. I mean, those are the kinds of things that have to change when you get these large truck bodies. So that's another example for you.
Thank you. That's helpful, Mr. Chair. Now I understand why Representative Max Fletcher had a 60 now and then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Swanson, Mr. Christensen, this is a very report to this committee, because we don't hear nearly enough of this as we should. We're so busy talking about transit, and light rail, and bridges, the congestion in Twin Cities, and we've tried to bring some of these issues up, because I'll point out that Congressman Overstar, who chairs the U.S. Transportation Committee, came in and talked to both the Senate and the House Transportation Committees earlier this year, and he did emphasize the explosion we're seeing in freight traffic, and your numbers bear it out with a 71% projected increase in the tonnage of freight movement. The yields are going up, no question about it. The other point that I'd like to make to the members, Mr. Chairman, and to the group here too, is that right now we can't put ethanol in the pipelines, and we can't put biodiesel in the pipelines. And you know, we as a state have come up with a 25% renewables by the year 25, and we're working hard on the Next Generation Energy Board. We're meeting tomorrow on these issues, that we're going to push for renewable energies and Minnesota-grown energies here as much as we can. And for us to do that, we've got to look at some of these great challenges we've got. And until we can get to the day where we can pipeline ethanol or biodiesel, we're going to be stuck with the freight traffic we've got from the semis and out with our auto semis.
I got a little lost. So we've actually had some of these big trucks coming down on us on some of these highway access. And I'm just wondering, how long is it that the governor has a task force to look at ethanol production? Is there a member of MnDOT that sits on that board so that as they're considering placing a new ethanol plant, that they're involved in the get-go instead of caring about something 2 or 3 steps down the road? I would think that's probably the most critical piece for you to be working on.
You are right, that we need to be in on the very beginning when we're thinking about an ethanol location, just as I described out here. How important it is that we build the transportation elements there, both for the highways and stuff, as well as the rail crossings, to make them safe and look like. So we haven't even spent any time here this evening, Chairman, talking about just our wind generation plans. They, too, are giving us very interesting dilemmas as far as how to handle freight movement. All those windmills, and just one blade is like 120 feet long, just moving them in and out. They're coming in continuously from North Dakota or Pipestone or Germany sometimes, wherever they're being made. Those kind of things moving in and out are tremendous freight issues. And we got those things hopping up like weeds around Southern Minnesota.
I guess I was reading the 2005 Legislative Auditor's Report, and one of the questions they raised there, and I think you're bearing out that we shouldn't listen to the that part of their auditor's report, is they're saying we should be looking at widening these roads and base it on economics, because they're saying that we're maybe spending too much money going to 10-ton roads with the full shoulders and that. And I think from what you're saying here, we should be building these roads out here with the shoulders, with the wide enough road lanes, build them heavy enough so they can handle the traffic. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yes, I think you are. You have to realize that in the state of Minnesota, for last year, that we had a low of 500 deaths in Minnesota on traffic accidents. Over half of those accidents were in rural Minnesota. Those are run off the road. A lot of them kind of accidents are running into each other. They are because of some of those narrow lanes. And the Federal Highway Administration study has shown for years that the extra width on any roadway, the next couple feet you have to the side, whether it's a 2 foot bituminous shoulder with a 5 foot gravel shoulder or something like that, is one of the biggest safety features you can do, because it gives people that room to pull over without hitting that lip and having to steer and then oversteering back into traffic or oversteering and going into the ditch. One of the safest things you can do out here. And so that's how important that is. The weight restrictions, yes, the counties struggle with that all the time. It's their people, their producers, that are having to deal with this. They need a haul all year round on 10-ton system. And so those county roads need to be upgraded.
Okay, one more question, Representative Warren.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've just watched that further study for a bit now, so it's exciting to finally see it presented. And you're absolutely right about the rail derailment. We just had the one in December right outside of Portland with an ethanol car. And glad to be working with Senator Sharon on the Minnesota Prairie line. So that line right now, with technical wrong, can go about 7 to 9 miles an hour. They take no more than 20 cars because the rail can't carry the weight. And so if we're going to move to the road, you need to focus on rail. I want to thank you with doing that. I just have one very quick question. How has the ethanol industry changed the number of trips trucks are making on the road? We have more truck trips, do we not, because of the ethanol industry?
The number of truck trips we have, two things are happening. One, they're traveling further from the farm to get to these ethanol plants, and secondly, it's creating a second level of truck trips with the DGPS and the ethanol moving to the final blending spot, Williams Pipeline Terminal, Coke Refinery in Twin Cities. Some of these truck trips are going all the way to Chicago. One thing that happens, semis get larger trucks and get more mobile with their goods. They're going longer distances to market to get a higher price as well. You don't have people using 14 now to get to Marshall when the price is higher over there than it is here in Mankato, and vice versa. They come on back the next day. So freight is not growing just because of the tonnage, but because of the complexity of trips and the distance of the trips.
I'm thinking, you were talking about the shoulders and the safety concerns that you have, and I'm wondering, do you have enough financial resources to fix the areas where you think that there should be shoulders that don't have them now?
No.
That's a question I can ask you. Your district budget is pretty well flat the last few years, or?
Very flat and going down.
Based on your need, probably.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, I need to ask him also, as a follow-up to that, and follow-up to Representative Hortman's question is, how District 7 sits on the federal earmark funds compared to, say, northeastern Minnesota.
You didn't hear that one, basically.
I heard the question, I just have no comment.
Thank you very much. We have a lot of testifiers, so appreciate your attention. And again, it emphasizes the fact that we need to have some additional funding for counties and MnDOT and township to over. I think the thing that you pointed out, which some of us were aware of, that ethanol basically has been relies pretty much on the trucking industry because we don't have pipelines, and up to this time they really haven't moved much of it in the rail. Rail wouldn't move it, I understand. Again, thank you for your question.
I would like to just say that this presentation we put on for the ASHTO hearings that were held this spring in the Twin Cities, as we're going around informing the new transportation bill on the national front, and this was one of the first times they had ever heard from rural communities about the changes that are going on in rural communities and why things are needed. So we need your support, and again, thank you all very much for coming down here. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Ellen Forster.
Hey, Andrew, thank you. I'd like to start with a thank you. Thank you very much for coming to Boomerang County. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Excuse me, we had another representative come in. I'm sorry, I didn't ask. Will you introduce yourself?
I'm Honor Hart from Cleveland. Nice to see you. There are a lot of you there.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I forgot to do that. That's fine.
And finally, I'd like to thank you very much for the legislature having passed very good comprehensive transportation bills in the last couple of sessions. They were not signed and became law, but the legislature did its part in passing a bill. Someone once said that everything is worth nothing unless it's in the right place. And that's what the business of transportation is all about, is to get it in the right place, whether it's freight or people. And as was pointed out very nicely with this freight study, we do need efficient transportation to compete, especially in Minnesota, where our products and our agricultural products are about as far from the world's market as you can get. Today, and for the foreseeable future in greater Minnesota, that means we'll need trucks, and probably heavier and bigger trucks to compete in the world market, and we'll need a good sound road and bridge system to support them. On the metro area, we have transportation needs. Certainly, we need more transportation capacity, and that will be some combination of roads and bridges and transit to be determined, I guess. In greater Minnesota, we have three big transportation needs. We have a need to move freight efficiently. We've got a need to have access, safe, reliable access for our citizens to various destinations. And we've got a great need to improve safety. The freight was handled very, very well by the freight study. I had the opportunity to be on that task force. And I would certainly like to thank Jim Swanson and MnDOT very much for bringing that study forward. It's a groundbreaking study that I think will be modeled around the state now. It pointed out the need for heavier roads, 10-ton roads, pointed out that we're hauling over twice as many tons off each acre of land than we were in the past because of the greater productivity. And then we're hauling that freight further because of ethanol and biodiesel and feedlots and value adding in the rural area, which has been a goal of ours and a need for years. Our roads are predominantly a 7-ton design, which means that most of our system in Blue Ridge County has the problems that we referred to earlier with the width of the lanes and the shoulders and steep end slopes and so on, but it also has a very weak pavement. They go back to the days when we were trying to get the folks out of the mud and have a pavement to drive on. And so we built basically the cheapest road that we could build so that we could get it widespread. And so much of our roads today are 6 to 10 inches of gravel with a thin bituminous pavement on it. When you load it with the heavy trucks and trailers and farm equipment, that means it will crack and it will rut, and you eat the life out of it. Today, coming from Rapidan, with the harvest starting, I could see the full semi trucks out of the field. I could see the large grain wagons, which I knew were going to go out onto this County 34 I was driving on. And you could just see that we're accelerating the deterioration of living off the past of those roads. Bridges, you got to have bridges to move freight. In Blue Earth County, we've got 16 structurally deficient bridges, three of which are in the process of being replaced this summer. One of which, and I'm sure you'll recognize some of these titles because the 35W bridge was a structurally deficient, fracture critical, non-redundant kind of structure across the Minnesota River. After this summer, we'll have 13 bridges, structurally deficient bridges. Cost to replace those would be about $5 million. We also have 4 functionally obsolete bridges, which would mean they're way too narrow or don't have sufficient clearance for emergency vehicles and for our trucking and ag equipment. Would cost about $1.5 million to replace those. One item I'd like to point out with our bridges is that there is a waiver to the bridge weight restrictions for ag equipment. And I'm sure that was well meant when it was passed, but it circumvents one of the few tools we have when we have these weak bridges to keep them safe for our public and to preserve them, and that's to put weight restrictions on them. So we're getting overloads, legal overloads, by that equipment, and I think that's something that needs to be looked at. According to data provided by the state, there are 1,826 structurally deficient or functionally obsolete bridges on the local road system. It would cost about $985 million to replace those bridges. If we could get caught up once and then do them as they become deficient each year, we'd have a manageable item. The problem is getting caught up once. Access for our citizens. Dr. Adams from the University of Minnesota has said that people who live in the country these days are pretty much the same as people who live in town. Their houses are just further apart. You know, they work in town, their children go to school in town, they take advantage of educational and cultural and health opportunities in town. They need and deserve good access to those destinations just as metro citizens and people in our cities do. Safety on our rural system, the 2-lane rural highways have the highest fatal crash rate of all types of highways. Actually, we folks in rural Minnesota think of ourselves as getting scared to death when we go up the cities and the freeways and all this traffic. But your most dangerous piece of road you drive on is that township road, and then the county road, and then the state highway, and finally the safest piece are those separated freeways. In Blue Earth County, we kill about 7 or 8 people per year. That's the equivalent in 2 years of a 35W bridge collapse. Unfortunately, we've gotten used to it, and we take it for granted, I guess. It's been pointed out many times for funding. There's been no gas tax increase since 1988. I've been in Blue Earth County about 20 years to correspond to that. When I first came to the county, diesel fuel was under $1 a gallon. Now we're buying it for our trucks, it's over $3 a gallon. Asphalt cement, the glue that holds our bituminous pavements together, cost less than $100 a ton then. Now it's $250 to $300 a ton. At the same time, the traffic has increased substantially and the need to move that freight and the heavier trucks has increased. The only adjustment has been that there's been additional fuel used, and so we've gotten a little bit more money off that. But it hasn't been nearly enough to compensate for those inflationary changes and for the traffic and the heavy freight. And now, actually, that has flattened out with the high cost of gasoline. So how is it possible to keep our traffic and our freight moving with that lower real income for our roads? It's because we're basically living off the investments our parents made. And we're borrowing money from what our children's income will be. And we're spending that for ourselves now. I guess what I would hope is that we start investing at the appropriate rates for ourselves and for our children. There are all kinds of studies, like the freight study, which show there's a good benefit-cost ratio. It would be a good investment to invest in congestion relief, to invest in more efficient freight. We need the funds to make those investments for our common good. Shifting taxes, there's been quite a shift. Years ago, back in the 50s, there was a deal made. The counties would take over the secondary highway system from the state. In exchange, we would get 29% of that highway user trust fund. And we would use those funds to maintain and construct those secondary highways to state standards. That has fallen way short. That deal has fallen way short in recent years. The bonding bills we've had in recent years have mostly gone to major MnDOT projects. The federal authorization bill increased federal funding coming into the state, but much of that, part of that has been taken to pay back bonds, which were dedicated for that source. Another part is being taken to go to a central fund, and I'm not arguing against that, only that part of it will go there for major projects. The balance goes to the ATPs, but only a small fraction of what goes to the ATPs actually goes to the county state aid highway system. I think in our ATP it's 21%. So when you get through that process of those additional federal funds, what will come to the counties for that secondary highway system will be very small. In addition, we've learned that MnDOT will be borrowing from the county state aid highway fund for 35W costs for cash flow reasons. We would like to borrow against those funds for our county state aid highways also. So we've got some concerns about that. There has been an increasing shift to property tax to fund those state aid highways. Our accountant looked up for me today. In the year 2006, for our county state aid highway system, we spent about $266,000 in property taxes to maintain that state aid system. In 2006, we spent about $3.2 million out of our property taxes to construct on that state aid system. So we're falling short in the deal to take over those highways. If you look at Blue Earth County needs to build the state standards that we referred to earlier with the width and shoulders and the strength of pavement, would cost about $100 million to construct our 420 miles of state aid highways to state standards. We've got another 300 miles of county roads, would cost about $100 million to bring those up to standards. We're fortunate in Blue Earth County, in the Mankato area here, it's growing as a regional center. To accommodate and facilitate and encourage that growth, we've taken on some major projects, County 90, County 82, and the future County 12 extension. We've done that by using assessments and tax abatement and special federal funding. There's a limited earmark fund that we've been able to get. We've tried to invest in those special projects. What I would request is that the legislature again consider a comprehensive transportation bill consisting of gas tax, vehicle registration, bonding, options for lineage tax. There's two good bills that were passed as examples. There are good proposals from ANC and from MICA to look at when the year starts. One more thing I'd like to mention before I sit down, and that's I think we can gain some efficiencies through regulatory reforms. And I feel strongly and support the need to preserve our environmental resources, but I think we could do it in some more efficient manner in some cases. For instance, with our wetlands, in Blue Earth County, we were blessed with lots and lots of wetlands. So virtually every road we built, we need to go through the wetland process. We need a Corps of Engineers permit, we need a Wetland Conservation Act permit, and we need a DNR public waters permit. And actually, the WCA and the Corps permits are relatively recent, modern programs. They specify a schedule. They specify what the mitigation requirements are so we can plan for that and fund that. What I would like, perhaps not you folks, but as the session gets started to consider is that the DNR public waters program has no schedule. So we're trying to keep this pipeline of projects moving. We need permits. We can request the DNR public water permit. We may get a response in 6 days, 6 weeks, or 6 years. The other programs, you get a response in 30 days or you have the permit. The DNR permit program has no set mitigation requirements. With the WCA, the Corps, if it's this kind of wetland, it's a 1.5 to 1. If it's this kind, it's 2 to 1. It may be 2.5 to 1. Need a DNR public waters permit. And actually, the WCA and the Corps permits are relatively recent, modern programs. They specify a schedule. They specify what the mitigation requirements are so we can plan for that and fund that. What I would like, perhaps not you folks, but as the session gets started to consider is that the DNR public waters program has no schedule. So we're trying to keep this pipeline of projects moving. We need permits. We can request the DNR public water permit. We may get a response in 6 days, 6 weeks, or 6 years. The other programs, you get a response in 30 days or you have the permit. The DNR permit program has no set mitigation requirements. With the WCA, the Corps, if it's this kind of wetland, it's a 1.5 to 1. If it's this kind, it's 2 to 1. It may be 2.5 to 1 depending on the quality of the wetland. The DNR program has no set mitigation requirements, so we don't know what the mitigation requirement will be until we finally get that permit back. And it may be very large. We have a recent example of a $3 million road reconstruction project where the DNR was going to issue the permit because it was recognized as a safety project, but the mitigation requirements would have cost us over $4 million. That effectively blocked that particular project, and we will construct a project, but it won't be as safe, it won't be as good for the people out there, and in my view, I don't think it's going to be as good environmentally, but I'm not really in a position to speak to that aspect of it. So, with that, and I went very fast, because this is a tremendous opportunity to speak with you folks, and they are a number of very disjointed items that were produced. I'd like to thank you very much for coming and for taking my testimony.
Mr. Forsberg, I neglected to point out you're on tape and did you identify yourself for the tape? And I forgot.
Oh,
you
and the certainly.
You should
certainly.
That's that, if you would, please.
Alan Forsberg, Blue Earth County Highway Engineer.
Great. Right. Can I see? You want to say
thank you, Mr. Chair. You have mentioned in passing an issue you wanted us to look at was the legal overload issue. And so I wanted to ask you about that, but I know in the interest of time, I wanted to ask you the other question at the same time so you can answer them both. You had mentioned the property tax burden on the Blue Earth County property taxpayers, and you had listed a couple numbers, but I didn't keep up. So just the legal overload issue, what your perspective is on that, and then the property tax burden.
And actually, we have an expert, Mike Wagner of Nicholas County, has been working with the committee, with the agricultural interest and AMC, looking at an issue where there is a law which says that implements of husbandry, trailer pulled by a tractor, for instance, does not have to follow the legal weight posting on a bridge. So you may have a bridge posted at, say, 24 tons, and a trailer may be loaded and be 40 tons. It is legal for that trailer to cross. That consumes additional life out of that bridge, and it creates some risk for that crossing as well as the vehicles that follow after it. So I think there's a need to look at that issue, and there is a committee, county engineers and AMC, that is looking at that issue. The numbers that you requested, Blue Earth County spent in the year 2006, $266,000 in local road and bridge funds on maintaining the county state aid highway system. We spent $3,249,000 in local road and bridge funds constructing on the state aid system.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for sure. I just want to clarify that you aren't using that money to build a bike path. These are road and bridges projects that you're spending that money on. Is that correct?
That's basically correct, although when we're in the Mankato area as a regional hub, we cooperate with the city of Mankato and provide sidewalk and or trail depending on their particular plan. We just support whatever reason bicycles.
Mr. Goldberg, they're identified in their needs, so the needs too are identified, but if they're not really taking on the project, that's something that's identified and funds left that way. Further questions? Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Father, is the new land camera. Really glad she's coming up to the members of the committee. This land camera was the pastor of the president of the National Association of County Officials. I feel I've got right here on the board.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Helen Lincoln. I'm the County Commissioner from Blue Earth County. I'm the immediate past president of the National Association of Counties, which I follow in the chairman's footsteps. So I thank you for forging the path for me. And I'm the past president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. As you've heard Mr. Forsberg talk so eloquently about Bluard County, I'm going to take a broader statewide perspective and testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I've got three basic principles that I'd like you to think about. The first priorities for transportation expenditures must be to improve safety across all transportation systems, provide additional capacity for farm-to-market commerce, reduce congestion, and increase mobility within Minnesota's population corridors across the state, including the use of transit alternatives, and it will spur economic viability across the state. The total transportation and transit revenue stream must be sufficient to preserve, improve, and expand Minnesota's transportation and transit infrastructure to meet both current and future needs. Transit systems must have a funding stream at a sufficient dedicated level to meet capital and operating costs and federal match requirements. And it must be separate from traditional transportation funding. Bridges. It's a huge issue for all of us. It gets more important all the time. We hope that you'll authorize state funding of $700 million to advance the schedule to replace and maintain the state's bridge infrastructure. We hope you'll use additional state funding authority of $450 million for the local bridge improvement program, and that over 4 years. That encompasses about 1,200 bridges statewide. And we hope you'll appropriate $5 million for new bridge inspection equipment that would be available for both local and state use. In transit, we hope you'll authorize one half percent local sales tax in the 7-county metro area and allow adjoining counties at their option. 50% of those dollars should be used to support transit services, which would be capital and operating costs. 25% for road and bridge systems, and 25% should be discretionary to be used for either transit or roads and bridges. In roads and bridges, we're encouraging you to increase gas tax by 5 cents immediately to be distributed over the current formula. We also hope that you'll increase the gas tax by 5 cents over the next 5 years under a plan developed by you, the legislature, to be distributed over the same formula. The state share of this increase would be used to support a $1 billion plus of state bonds, and that's how that would be gained. We hope you'll adjust the motor vehicle fees as provided in the bill passed by the 2007 legislature. We hope you'll authorize the local option of up to $20 on a wheelage tax. We also hope you'll allow 0.5% sales tax for non-metro counties if the proceeds of the tax are dedicated to specific transportation projects. Some of the general conditions we'd love to see, we hope you'll establish a low-income tax credit to reflect the increased sales and gas tax. And we hope you'll establish a low-income bus tax for all transit systems. As we look at the future for funding, we know things are going to change. So we hope that you'll appoint a joint state, city, county study commission to research and recommend alternative financing options for future funding discussions. You know, when we talk about gas tax and we talk about property tax, I've been lucky. I got to testify in front of the National Commission 3 times because I'm the president of the National Association. And talked about the huge disconnect there is as to how transportation is paid for. The federal government has a gas tax. The state government has a gas tax. We fund many of our roads off property tax. There's a huge disconnect. People understand a gas tax. They understand paying for a gas tax and thinking it goes to roads and bridges. Property tax doesn't quite compute for people. It's not a fair tax. And so the question is, what should be paying for what? So we hope you'll think about that. We see that at the federal level, we see it at the state level. We don't have those options at the local level. We have to use property tax.
The other thing is, in 2009, there's going to be a $4.3 billion shortfall in the highway trust. So the money's not going to come from them. They need to figure out how they're going to plug that hole. We need to figure out how we're going to plug this hole here. We have to invest. We haven't done it for a long, long time. Now's the time. We can't wait any longer. Every trip that is made usually starts on a local road. And so we encourage you to invest in transportation. We encourage you to step up to the plate and do this right. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How do you feel about tolls? Have been some suggestions that we ought to go to tolling.
Representative Earhart, I am fortunate enough to serve with Representative Earhart on the Center for Transportation Studies, so we get to have these discussions every once in a while. I think you have to have the whole toolbox out there and figure out what works, what doesn't. Unfortunately, with tolls in rural areas, what roads do you toll? You can't toll them all. And so you just then make different paths to work that don't make a lot of sense, and you can't cash flow the toll roads. So those are issues. But I think you have to have the whole toolbox so you can look at it, see what works, where it works, and how you can be fair and equitable across the board. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. I think you did a pretty good job of representing them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next testifier is Mark Anderson from the City of Vancouver. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Mark Anderson, and I'm the foreman. I oversee the day-to-day operations of the transport system in Vancouver.
Is that with MTA or the local transit system, the city transit?
Correct. That's city. And I guess I'm here tonight just because I'm concerned about the state of funding for public transit in the state of Minnesota. The good news is that ridership is up 7% over the same time last year. We operate 7 fixed routes, 2 paratransit routes, and 2 service routes, subscription routes. And they're all doing well. Places that we fall down are basically 3 areas. Our fare boxes, the paratransit section of our service delivery, and the night service. Our fare boxes currently are operating on GOS. It's a very old operating system, antiquated. It's very difficult to get tech support from, and fare boxes are what we use to calculate what's successful and what's not, how much money's coming in, what passes are being sold, who's buying them, that type of thing. And right now, it just went down. Our laptop went down that we used to interface with the fare boxes to extract this information. And I was just informed by IT last week that this is the last time it can be purchased. It's a very expensive purchase. It's $250,000 for 14 fare boxes. But we're on our last leg for that. My second area of concern is our paratransit service. And this is the part of our service. It's a complimentary service that operates in addition to the fixed routes. And it serves folks with disabilities that can't use or access the regular public transit bus. 30% of our passengers are wheelchair bound, and it consumes 22% of our operating hours and returns about 3% of our ridership. Unfortunately, the demand is incredible for this service, and I think it's going to do nothing but increase. In the last 10 years, we started out, we have 25 people on our reservation list that were certified to use the service. Right now, we just purged our files. We have 412 certified people, with 317 of them active. And that means that they've used the service in the last 2 months. And we take calls probably 3 a day looking, you know, for passengers that want to get on the service. And you can't possibly handle them all. And I have a great deal of concern, not just for Mankato, but statewide, but, of how we're going to handle this. There's been a lot of talk about coordination, and it's a great idea. It's, it'll help a lot. I don't think it's the answer, you know, to everything, but I hope it does something. And lastly, is our night service. Back in 2000, I guess, MnDOT and the city of Mankato endorsed and paid for a consultant to make recommendations to change, for changes to our system. And they went ahead and implemented the transit service and operational redesign plan. They essentially changed the structure of the management, changed the size of the buses, changed the routes of the buses, did everything to kind of get us out of the red, and it worked. So we've done everything that was asked of us in the plan. The third thing that was asked was to implement night service, and we did that in 2006, and we tweaked it a little bit. It essentially runs from the MSU campus and the apartment complexes up in that area to the east end of town. And it's grown by 34% from the first quarter to the second quarter. And if you compare September this year to September of 06, it's grown by 74%. So it's a very successful route. And we just asked that MnDOT kick in some funds and help us pay for it. It's in danger right now. It's a coordinated effort between MSU and the city of Mankato, with MnDOT having no involvement in it at all, other than we use a MnDOT purchased vehicle.
Just to get two questions, and I guess from the earlier comment that was made. The first one is, how much money do you get for to operate your bus system out of the Highway User Trust Fund? And I think I would know the answer to that. But the second one is that what I'm hearing you say, and I guess it's coming through to me loud and clear, is not just in the metro area, but out here in outstate Minnesota, you also need transit dollars invested in the system.
Correct. And I don't know the answer to your first one. The financial part of our operation is done by the finance director.
I know the answer to that, not that you get zero out of you, which is the gas tax. So nothing comes from the gas tax here.
Okay.
Representative
Magnus. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, can you tell me the what percent of your commercial expenses are repaired, covered by your fare?
About 22%
by the ferry.
Correct.
And your ridership has increased, I think you said
7%.
70%?
7%.
Oh, 7%.
Yeah, 7%. The night service was 74% from September this year compared to September of 2006.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess my next question is, if the ferry covered 22% of the cost, how much can you raise the fares?
You can't raise the fares very much. What happens is, what we've experienced in the past is you'll get an initial bump in revenues, and then you'll get a general slide down, and generally settles below where you were at before.
Mr. Anderson, I think you get some money from the indirectly from the feds, and then. But anyhow, you get money, I think, to the state, don't you?
Yes, we do.
Did you have a question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. You said that you have 412 people certified. Can I ask what your population is for use for the Paris transit? Do you have any idea what the total population is in the community that you're serving to have 412 people certified to use?
I don't know. We have. You know, we have MRCI is here, so we have a large population of folks with disabilities. And also just being in a regional center, you have a lot of people retiring in here and a lot of nursing homes.
Yes, and you said one more follow-up. And then if you just tell me, as far as the paratransit is concerned, what are the hours? Is it something that a person that wants to work would be able to take advantage of, or is it a permit?
It's exactly aligned with the fixed routes.
It is?
Yeah.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was interesting you said that 22% came from farebox recovery, because that's about exactly how much of road funding the gas tax paid for. And so, you know, when we fill up our tank, we kind of think our gas tax is paying for all of the roads, but actually it's only paying for 21.5%. So just as we subsidize roads with property taxes and other kinds of funding, it sounds like the subsidy is almost identical for transit as it is for roads.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Chrysler? Welcome to the place.
Thank you. Actually, I know exactly where it came from. I was born in
That's right. There's a place so that your brother's doing the insurance on.
Yep, there is. My name is David Chrysler, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, and we're based here in Mankato. And actually, we just moved in the last month from representing Morrow's district into representing Finer's district. We're in North Mankato, and I live in Mankato. Thanks for the opportunity to visit with you just a little bit this evening. One of the things that I've asked and passing around is just a little bit more detail about the pork industry in Minnesota. It is a very vibrant industry within the state. You saw some of the numbers earlier. Numbers and hogs that are in the district that we're in here. But one of the pieces that was missing was the economic impact. And the piece that I'm handing out to you goes over some of that. We're annually, the pork industry in Minnesota generates $8 billion worth of economic impact in the state. And a good chunk of that is in the southern one-third of the state. And in fact, we've got a couple of gentlemen here that have got a good chunk of it themselves in their districts. If we could look at just Representative Morrow's district and Representative Magnus' district, combine them up, they have 18% of pork production in the state in their two districts. And so it's something that's very important to rural Minnesota. Generates a little over 22,000 jobs in the southern third of the state. And so it's keeping people out here in rural Minnesota, and it's been a real success story from that standpoint. Our organization and myself represent the majority of pork producers and pork production in the state. I already talked about the handout. And again, it's a growing business, and it's been a very good business for the state and for the state's farmers. One of the reasons that it has grown is because of infrastructure. And we have a very good infrastructure from the standpoint of supplying feed to our animals. Primarily, it's corn and soybean meal. And the soybean processing plants that have been built in Minnesota in the last couple of years would not have been built here unless you have swine population that is within the state to consume the byproduct of the soybean meal that comes out of those plants. So the plants in Brewster, the plant in Fairmont, some of the upgrades that have happened here in Mankato would not have happened if this industry wasn't here. So there's a big spillover effect into other businesses, along with some international offices for feed companies that are located right here in Mankato. Also, our processing plants, we have two major ones in southern Minnesota, a processing plant in Austin and also one in Wilmington. Both are about the same size, process about 19,000 head of hogs per day in each one of those plants. That's about 60% of the hogs that are produced in the state of Minnesota. Our other 40% go to plants that are in Iowa or in South Dakota. But we do process about 60% of our production in the state. And those are shipped all over the world, especially the plant that's in Wilmington, ships internationally. The plant in Austin, the normal plant, is more of a domestic plant, but also does do some international work. We also have got an abundance of land. Manure is in high demand from crop producers. One of the things that people really don't know about or appreciate is that we look at commercial fertilizer that we put on the land in order to grow a crop. We can use manure instead of commercial fertilizer. It can be a direct replacement. And with high fuel costs, commercial fertilizer prices have skyrocketed. Okay? And we look at the case of nitrogen. 90% of the cost of making commercial nitrogen is natural gas, or the cost of natural gas. Okay? So as natural gas went up, so did commercial nitrogen. It's roughly doubled. Okay? Commercial fertilizer prices have roughly doubled in the last just few years. So we have incredible demand from crop farmers purchasing manure from livestock farmers as a commodity to substitute for commercial fertilizer. And that's something that's really a whole new business that's occurred within about the last 5 to 6 years. It's a commodity that's bought and traded and sold. It's not a waste, it's a resource. One of the other pieces, though, when we look at infrastructure, is roads. And just like you saw with the presentation, and actually it's the third time that I've seen that presentation, the PowerPoint that you just saw. In fact, I showed it to our board a couple of weeks ago, so our board has had a chance to take a look at it also. But the majority of other ag and non-ag businesses, we are using semi-tractor trailers as the most common freight hauling vehicle. It helps us be more efficient. And the other thing when we're transporting pigs is that it's also a more welfare and friendly way to handle the pigs. Our old traditional system is that you would have small lots of hogs that would go to a central buying station that may be in your community, and your community, and your community, and those hogs would be offloaded, mixed with other hogs, and they would fight, and then loaded onto a semi, and then go on to a packing plant. With this system, we load pigs that have all been together their whole lives onto a semi. They know what to expect, and they go straight to that packing plant. It's actually a much more welfare-friendly system than what we did 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. We're not going back to what we did before. This is a better system. Our primary concerns are really very similar to what we've heard from the previous speakers. It's safety and capacity. As we look at, we're concerned about safety with these roads. If you have semis that are on gravel roads, you have semis that are on these older or small or narrow tar roads, there is a safety parameter. We appreciate that, and we think we agree that is a big deal. Capacity is also a big deal. It is a very high priority for us to upgrade our rural roads to a 10-ton system. And I've gotten to know county highway engineers better than I thought I would get to know them over the last couple of years in discussing some of this. And we have been engaged in conversations on how we can make some of this work out better for the longer term, both for the roads and from the business standpoint. And we look forward to continuing those conversations, especially as we look at addressing bridges. And we understand that that's a concern. We believe that we can somehow reach some sort of a compromise or a good position for both of us as we go forward, and we're committed to trying to work that out. A couple of other things, kind of just to switch gears, at least from our standpoint, it is not, and it has never been a priority of ours to have overweight permits. Okay? We are much more concerned about upgrading the roads that we have today to 80,000 pounds than we are figuring out how to get permits to go above. And so from a standpoint of priority, that's, I guess, how we would like to look at it. So let's look at upgrading the system that we have rather than looking at trying to go heavier. We've got a lot of work to do with the system that we've got today. Some things that we're in favor of to try and get to that direction is that we are in favor of a gas tax increase. We have been in favor of a gas tax increase for 4 years. Something was passed at an annual meeting 4 years ago. We didn't put a dollar figure to it or a cents per gallon to it because we know things can change. We passed a resolution that said we're in favor of an increase. We're also in favor of some other mechanisms for raising dollars, especially looking at bonding. We're not necessarily bought into the complete argument that everything needs to go out into rural Minnesota. We know we've got a state system. We also know that we have to look at agreeing to something, that just saying no to some of this isn't going to help us in the long term, because zero times zero is still zero. And we're not ever going to get ahead unless we get moving on this in some sort of a way that can hopefully satisfy as many people as possible, and obviously the constituencies that you have. We do have some concerns, however, about supporting a county option for gas tax increases, because we think it creates some winners and losers. If you happen to be a county that's fortunate enough that has a regional trade center act, like we're sitting in today, it could be a real advantage for you. If you happen to be in Murray County, it may not be that much of an advantage. And so we do have some concerns about that, because we all know that most of us travel to our regional trade centers to do a lot of our business, or we've got one or both spouses that are working in that regional trade center. It's just where a lot of the economists is really gone. And so as we look at that funding mechanism, we think we could create some winners and losers with that, especially, again, if you're in one of those counties that doesn't necessarily or doesn't have one of those regional trade centers. With that, I guess what I'd like to do is probably stop, because you know, you've got lots of other folks, and if there's questions, we'd be happy to try and answer a couple of questions.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. There was a county option for a sales tax, not for gas tax, in what we had talked about. And that was at the option of the county for the referendum and for specific purposes, to this road or do something else, and then it terminated after the project was done. But I do have a question here. If pigs cannot sweat, which I'm reading about here, well, not every smell for them.
But it does bring up, when you look at issues around board, it does bring up some challenges as we look at siting facilities. You know, we want to site facilities where it's going to work within the community, right? Which means we need to have, you know, receptors. Basically, setbacks are going to work from neighbors. Well, that sometimes means that you aren't able to put it on the heaviest road that you can. So it can create some challenges from that standpoint. But I guess the best to answer your question depends on the eye of the hole, I guess.
Are there any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, I hope the committee pays some attention to Dave's reference there, Mr. Price there. So, Dave,
I don't know
what we're having a long time to his discussion about this local option sales tax stuff. And we heard some testimony earlier that wasn't that I didn't agree with either, because I do agree with Dave, because I don't live in a regional center, and he's exactly right. And the proposal we had in the past, where you have a project-specific sales tax option come in and vote on that, I don't think is the way to go for rural Minnesota. Because, again, you're going to have the regional centers taking more money away from the areas now. You know. But just a point. There are 15 to 20 local option sales taxes in rural Minnesota in towns now, all across the state, all the way from the larger ones like Duluth. I don't remember, might Gail have one? So I don't think that has water. I mean, they're all across the state now. 15 or 20, I got a list of them somewhere.
We have a lot of testifiers. Yeah, very much.
Thank you.
For the person coming up, there are 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11, 14 people that testify. And if you could condense your testimony, we appreciate it to some degree. And the members are also aware of that. The next person is Mr. Sanford, and Ed Dennison, the engineer. Oh, wait, really? Oh, I didn't know where Jerry from, that's what I assumed. Mayor, you must thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to come this evening. You're representing the City of North Mankato as well as the Highway 14 Partnership, which is made up of cities, counties, Chamber of Commerce, and local businesses all along Highway 14 between New Ulm and Rochester that have been lobbying and constantly coming before you and other members of Congress to try and the legislature to try and get some additional funding to get this project completed. We've been working on it for over 4 decades now, and we're still not done. We've got a long way to go. But Highway 14 is the example of the piecemeal approach to funding of highway improvements. I made a real mistake tonight. I should have insisted that all members coming from the north drive down on Highway 35, get off in Owatonna, and take 14 from here, or from 14 from Owatonna to Mankato, to get an opportunity to see how that type of a road building process does not function well. The most interesting example was when they opened up the new lane, four lanes over to Janesville. Our governor came that way. Senator Coleman came that way. Guess what? They both got stopped by trains in Wauseka because they didn't have enough money to complete the rally around Wauseka, so we stopped short and drove, put the road into the town, going over the railroad tracks, which we were trying to get away from originally. So now we're going to have another roadblock, plus you still have to go through the city of Wauseka, which is a roadblock. These have caused tremendous problems on Highway 14, and they're only getting worse. Four lanes from Rochester to New Ulm would cost in current dollars approximately $423 million. There is no hope of finding that money right now. We just spent Friday talking with Congressman Oberstar and Congressman Walz trying to come up with more federal funding for this program. You know what was really disturbing is they talked about, yes, we'll really work hard to get the money. But if we get it for you, can you put up the matching funds in the state of Minnesota to get it done? We had no answer for them. We were trying to find a way of doing it, but it's really disturbing if he says, we got you $40 million, could you match it? I said, well, we'll do our best to do it. But isn't that a really disturbing comment? If we can get the money, we may not be able to do it. The North Main Cato to New Orleans stretch of it is my personal piece. It's very important to me. It's the last leg coming to the west, and people ask why stop in New Ulm. Well, if you see the traffic studies, the traffic from New Ulm out west really drops off considerably. But what most people aren't aware of is that New Ulm is a hub of freight traffic. I'm not sure why, but it's been a huge freight center with a number of freight firms coming out of it. Believe it or not, guess which way most of them go? They come down 14 and come to North Mankato, they get on 169, or they're about to stay on 14, you head over to 35. The traffic count on that stretch of road, which is about roughly 30 miles, is about 10,000 cars a day coming into North Mankato, of which 1,000 are residents. Now, why is that personal to me? The stretch of road that we've been working on, which is 41-14 overpass and a stretch of highway coming out of North Mankato going west, which is very important because it's our next major crossing of that road. On the south side is our fast-growing residential area. On the north side is our industrial park, which we're just expanding by another 90 acres, and it's already starting to be used up already, so we've got more trucks coming in there. That stretch of road was supposed to have been done in 2006. Well, as you know, it's now was 2008, then it was 2010, 2012. It was 2015, and the last stiff it just disappeared. It's no longer somewhere around 2020. Well, this spring I got a phone call. We had another accident on 14. The highway was closed. That tells us exactly what's going on. When the highway's closed, we know there's another death out there. I was mad. I was on the phone to Representative Morrow. I was on the phone to Representative Sharon. I was calling Congressman Walz. On my other phone, it rang. My brother-in-law. That was my brother-in-law killed out there. On the stretch of road that should have been done in 2006. So it's personal to me, but it's also personal for the city, because you can talk to just about every person in this room that's local and ask them. They know somebody that's died on that highway. It's a death trap, and it's not getting any better at this stage. State funding has remained flat. It's been a problem. I'm also on the ATP 7 for this region. We just had a meeting with Jim, and I commend Jim. He does more with less than any person I've ever seen. And he's got less, and it's getting less all the time. We have some county representative engineers here that were as adamant as ever seen them because of the new federal mandates that are put on the safety issues that are taking money out of the little we have and putting into mandated safety concerns that obviously were written by people that don't understand our county roads. Put rumble strips on roads are great, but when it's an 11-foot section of road or 11-foot wide, and you try to put a rumble strip line, you'll be driving on half the time anyway, so it doesn't really serve the purpose. And the other half of the time, the roads aren't in a condition to put a rumble strip in. You put it in, it's going to destroy the road. So that's not going to solve the problem. But that's where we have to put the money, not where it should be put. North Mankato, we talked about sales taxes. North Mankato has a request for a sales tax has been carried very well by our representatives. It was in the tax bill. $1.5 million of that sales tax was going to go to fund the North Mankato's portion of the 1441 overpass. As you all know, that bill got vetoed also, so now we don't have highway funding, we also don't have the tax bill to get it in our part of the going. So this is very, very important to us in the city of North Mankato. I'll try to go as fast as I can here to pull this together, but I just want to throw a few items around here, and some of this has already been said, but between 2000 and 2005, 75% of the fatalities on Highway 14 were on a two-lane portion of that road. That just goes to show you, if we expand it, how much safer it is. I've lost two really good friends, plus a brother-in-law on that highway within the last 3 years. I don't want to see any more go. We've had 26 fatal crashes between 2000 and 2005, which was over 33 deaths. That doesn't count the people that have been late or harmed or been handicapped because of whatever. God knows what else is going on. It's a dangerous road. Might be a little critical here, but I really believe that any legislature who supports Highway 14 and voted against that bill last year made a tremendous mistake. And that's a hard statement to make, but I don't know how you can vote against it without coming up with a better option if you live along that stretch of road, because it has to be done. It has to be done now. We have six state legislators who are along Highway 14 that did not vote for that bill, and I think that's unacceptable. I hope the governor should not have vetoed it, but if he did, he's got to come up with some bipartisan program and get this thing going again. The Highway 14 partnership supported the 5% or 5 cent gas tax increase. Probably needs to be more, but we have to get started somewhere. I don't care where the money comes from. It's got to be done. We don't have it out here. We can't take any more away from our citizens. We scraped and we're putting our budget together, and I think the city of Mankato and the county said, we're all looking at our budgets. And I'll tell you one thing, the only way we can make them balance is property taxes have to go up. And we just can't continue to be going up and up and up. I guess the last thing, I'm accused of being facetious sometimes, but I think we'd have to have a bill that's going to address all of our issues. It should have been handled in a special session. I don't know if it's going to happen, but if at all possible, we ask you to try and get it done yet this year. If not, as soon as the session starts next year, let's not wait till the end. Let's get it done right away. I think the story in the Tribune this weekend was probably the epitome of what's happening in the state of Minnesota. Not only are our bridges falling, our roads are falling, but the Department of Transportation building is falling apart. What more could we be telling the nation about what we're doing here in Minnesota? This isn't the Minnesota that we all, grew up in. I'd like to see it get back to where it is. So I'll stop there, and I know you have a lot of other people. Thank you.
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, yes. Gary Zomer, Mayor of the City of North Mankato.
Thank you. One thing I have to point out is today. Right now, the new bridge construction on 35W hinges on some signatures from legislators, Representative Magnus and myself. Because the state doesn't have the money, you can't let a contract unless you show you got the money. The state does not have the money to award this contract on 35W right now. The state is going to give basically a letter of credit saying we anticipate we're going to get $195 million from the federal government. But I don't know if that's going to be acceptable. But as you know, and any county and city engineer know, you can't let a contract unless you got the money back there. And for this project, we got 10 days till next Monday, I think, maybe, till we sign that, if we sign it or not. That's where we're at. If we don't sign it, you're going to see some more delays in this project. MnDOT is looking, Jim here, you better be looking when he's going to cut back, because that's what's going on. We recognize the fact that that bridge needs to be built. I don't think that anybody in here is going to say we're not going to build that bridge. But we have to start sending a message home, and somehow, I think the public is aware of it, but somehow, somewhere, we're not getting this funding bill, and that just wanted you to know that that's not only one of the situations with the cash flow of the building office. Right now, the commuter rail, the same thing. If you talk to the county engineers, we're going to borrow some money, and MnDOT's going to borrow money from the county and municipal system to be able to match the federal money for the commuter rail. otherwise you're not fully accountable to the payment, and you're going to win, you're set back. That's just a little bit of it, right? And we're, he's got to sign the bill, I got to sign the bill, we got a paper that they call a legislative, MAC, legislative, yeah, legislative driver's council. I'm on it, I guess. I forgot the name. But right now, the MnDOT cannot let this contract until we sign that, and that's where we're at. It's just the money isn't there, so that's why we're having this meeting to determine if there's an apparent that people think we need to have some money somewhere. And again, it's a question of perception there.
Where is that money coming from that you guys are going to sign for?
It's supposedly they're waiting for the company to finish.
Well, I understand that. But in the meantime, what part of money are you going to take it out of? Are you going to...
If they don't get the money, if they have to delay other projects, right. That's what they're going to do, take that money. And a lot of these solutions, they are, some of them are talking about, they're going to see less. And they have some of that for me.
So in order to do the bridge, you two guys are going to sign, along with others, the borrowing from other projects that will be shut down.
Well, we're basically signing a letter of credit on the assumption that we're going to get that federal money, $195 million. That's really good enough. But if that doesn't happen, technically, yes, we're taking it from other projects. Delaying. Representative Wharton.
I just wanted to let you know that when we debated the transportation bill, one of the most eloquent speeches that was given on the bill was Representative Morrow talking about each of the fatalities in the, I think it was the last 2 years. And so I know we're here in Mankato tonight, but you probably would be bored to tears if you watched this on TV all the time, but you should know that your representatives are bringing the story of things like County Road 14 to St. Paul.
Yeah. And if you know your mayor, it used to be a new home, Carl Wychowski, that's been 30 years ago. He's been in there fighting. We still don't have it. Representing Nelson.
I was just going to say, and we appreciate, from the metro area, our relatives that live out this way, live out on Highway 60. But I also appreciate the fact that last year, to fund Crosstown project, the other project in the metro area that was going to be done was in my district, and that got stopped, and now it's going to get postponed again. So we also understand projects being delayed and delayed and delayed, and it's something, unless we get more money into the system somehow, we're never going to get rid of this backlog of projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quick, I think people in the public ought to know, our Minnesota Department of Transportation is literally bankrupt. And this whole issue of shifting money around to cover short-term things happened long before the bridge. I mean, that's why Representative Nelson's comment is appropriate. And we can't continue like this. We have to have a bankrupt state agency that's constantly stealing money from other things. We need a long-term comprehensive transportation bill so that you really get at these issues and to match the federal money. I thought that was very telling what you said about Congressman Wallace. So I hope we can get that bill done very, very soon.
Again, thank you very much.
My name is Ken Sackler. I'm the Mankato Director of Engineering. And I have one thing here that I circulate, and maybe we can cover this briefly. I'd like to talk about Mankato's regional center that everybody's been referring to. We really work to make that happen, and we've worked with MnDOT on regional concepts very successfully. And we also work with our neighboring cities and counties. In the last several years, we've had the Eden Prairie, Bloomington to Mankato, Trump Highway 169 corridor, which we recognize as a main artery that we want to preserve and enhance between the two cities. Obviously, any section of roadway or any transportation is expected to benefit both ends of that transportation network. So we look to the metro area as well as our area trying to move things forward. We've worked with the Park Highway 14 Coalition, as Mayor Zellmer indicated, between Rochester and Long by Owatonna to make that east-west connection for our neighbors. We use our partnership on the ATP 7 to encourage logical improvements along Trunk Highway 60 to Bedelia, St. James, Windham, Worthington, and on to Sioux City and Sioux Falls, you know, that are out of state because of that recognition that we need to create that network. We've also worked with the local district to identify a maintenance and design office that was deficient and inadequate to serve Southern Minnesota. The city went out and invested over $1 million in site preparation to a site determined by MnDOT to be their preferred location, and invested in municipal services, including drainage and street, in anticipation of a facility out there. We continue to hold that site and our investment in anticipation that the facility will be constructed and forthcoming sometime in the future. We understand that that takes extra money. We've even accepted turnbacks on from highways to either the county system and encourage different turnbacks to local townships. We've also looked at jurisdictional changes, trying to become more efficient in our transportation network efforts, and that takes cooperation between the cities, counties, and townships. In addition, I just got an email communication last month, July 30th, I guess it's over a month now, that MnDOT is considering turning back to the Veterans Bridge downtown to the city and the counties. Obviously, we're in no position to take over the inspection and maintenance on a bridge as massive as that crossing the major river. Maybe Brewer County and Nicholl County have some capabilities, but obviously none of us can assume that kind of responsibility without some additional partnerships and funding to go with it. We believe that MnDOT is probably the most appropriate entity to manage that interchange in Highway 169 with the two downtowns of Mankato and North Mankato. The city, however, would be willing to take over some of the ramps. We have what we call a city center renaissance concept where we'll be converting the partial floor relief that's out there to a signalized standard intersection, and we would be willing to work with MnDOT to accomplish that portion of the work. What I'm trying to point out here is with these partnerships, all the partners have to contribute something. And we feel that right now MnDOT is having a tough time fulfilling their part of that commitment. And I'm not presumptuous enough to suggest to the Legislative Transportation Finance Committee what the best way to do that is. I think you've got resources and advisors that are a lot better than I am to qualify for that type of advice. But I'm just pointing out that these good things that we're doing need money in addition to cooperation. I'd like to mention a little bit about our state aid system. The 9% of the state aid funds that go to the cities yield about $1 million for Mankato. It's been as low as $800,000, it's been as high as $1.2 million. It's about $1 million at the present time. We allocate $1,500 per mile for general funds, for snow plowing, seal coating, patching, and the like, on our collector system of 32 miles. It by no means covers these costs. We reserve the balance of the maintenance funds, which run about $220,000 a year, for significant overlays, increased reliability, for traffic signal maintenance and replacement, and siding programs. We construct the typical state aid street reconstruct typical state aid street every year. We expend the balance of the funds. About 50% of the funds on any segment of the state aid street are eligible for state aid funding. The rest is sewer replacements, water replacements, other utilities, sidewalks, accessible curb, that kind of improvement. So right now, that part of the state aid roadway has a needs that we need to fulfill of $35 million, according to the state report. So that's what we would need to do to bring our roads up to standards, and that's only for that half. Obviously, you can tell that an expenditure of $800,000 or $1 million a year even is not going to accomplish that in 40 years. By that time, the rest of the roadway system will be deteriorated. We believe our all cities face the same dilemma, but we try to lessen the burden in our area by levying about 30% of our budget for road improvements. We levy for maintenance, we levy for bonded road construction, and we levy for developments. This is transferred gas tax eligible items for on a project to the local real estate tax burden. We have also not designated certain routes that should have been state aid routes and left them on the local system and went to the abutting properties in development areas and said, developer, it's necessary for you to pay for this roadway if you want it. Now, it's not collusion or coercion, but it's really going to a developer and saying, if you want to do this, you got to pay the whole cost. That has had an impact on whether some improvements and some developments take place. Our major shopping center has sort of deferred some of their needed improvements because of that posture that we've taken. It's unfortunate, but it's where we are. I looked over the past 7 years to see how much of these types of improvements our state aid fund is covered with local dollars, either assessments or general taxes. In 2007, there's four segments worth about $1.9 million. In 2006, there were two projects worth $510,000. In 2005, there were three projects worth $2.1 million. In 2004, there were five projects worth $2.3 million. In 2003, there were two at $1.5 million. In 2002, there were none. And in 2001, there were two at $2.4 million. This is a shortage that can only be resolved with an increase in revenues. We feel that MnDOT and our agencies and the counties have really done all they can to bring the last benefit out of every segment of roadway we have, and we believe that we need the money to meet the expectations of the public.
Thank you, Mr. Sackler. Appreciate it. We have 10 testifiers left. I appreciate that you have written testimony, and would like to say if anyone has written testimony to leave it with us, appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Sackler. Thank you. And also, Mr. Levine is with the Railroad for United Transportation thing. I was just wondering, Mr. Levine.
And our agencies and the counties have really done all they can to wring the last benefit out of every segment of roadway we have. And we believe that we need the money to meet the expectations of the public.
Thank you, Mr. Sackler. Appreciate it. We have 10 testifiers left, and I appreciate that you have written testimony, and would like to say if anyone has written testimony to leave it with us, appreciate it, thank you, have it, Mr. Sackler. Thank you. And also, Mr. Levine is with the Railroad for United Transportation thing. I was just wondering, Mr. Levine, because we have testimony from Mr. Folly, and I believe you will be testifying. I don't want to cut the railroads off, but if you want to testify, I've got you coming somewhere down the line, but I didn't know if you wanted to, because basically it was a safety issue you're going to discuss, if it was a safety issue or not. But anyhow, we can put you back on, but I just want to check and let the members, the persons here know that the railroads also want to testify. So
so. But I do it going ahead and send it right now. So.
Yeah, I
didn't start
it out. Before,
I'm going to take 5 minutes of your time. Okay, it'll be very short. Otherwise, I'll go say, run out. We're losing more time right now. We got more there, too.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, thanks for this opportunity. My name is Matt Levine. I represent United Transportation Union. We run from St. Paul down through Mankato here, down to St. James, to City on these trains. I'll keep it short. I know Quali likes to talk a lot.
He did.
First thing I want to bring up is the fact that we try to work with our carriers. I work for the UP. But we try to work with the carriers whenever possible to get safety issues taken care of. Point number one, the Carver Bridge collapsed March 23rd down in Chaska. That could have been avoidable. I don't know if the state inspector idea would have done it, but some of these bridges on short lines are 100 years old. And these are things that, you know, the inspection rarely, if ever, really takes place in kind of good quality inspection of bridges. Culverts, there's a lot of washouts with all this rain. Biggest thing that I'm looking at here is all the ethanol we got, all the hazardous materials. If one of those bridges or culverts gives way, from Mankato south to Sioux City and Butterfield down to Mason City, it's all dark territory. There's no signal protection of the track. If something got washed out and you got a train going at 50 miles an hour, you could possibly, you know, have a major catastrophe. And pretty much every one of these railroads goes through town, whether it's big or small, the catastrophe is still the same. Another thing I'd like to see is basically just more inspections. Get the state involved, get MnDOT involved with getting some more inspections of these main lines. As they said earlier on this, and I like the presentation, by the way, there's a lot of unit trains, there's more ethanol plants. I personally worked on these ethanol trains and these grain elevators, and there's derails that are too close to the main line. Without that signal protection, if one of those cars moved 10 feet that's on the main, you could have a head-on collision. Big catastrophe, and a lot of people pay the price for that. Not to mention the fact that the thing with the railroad crossings, Vidalia, the grain elevator, is a crossing right there. We've had so many ministers on the UP there. Same with Lady Crystal, the ethanol plant. Stuff that needs to be looked at that I'd like to see the state get involved in. I just want to make sure you guys are all aware of these issues. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'll be out here later.
Thank you. We did pass the bill this last session. I don't remember some of the numbers we passed in railroad safety. And I think part of it was vetoed and failed with Mr. Representative. So we're looking at it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We didn't veto this chairman. We didn't policy.
Some people like to talk a really long time in the last minute session, so we didn't get to do that one.
Mr. Zerk.
That was me. When was
she's the... Didn't
have enough tape.
Greater Mankato Economic Development Corporation.
That's right. My name is Jonathan Zerk, and I represent the Greater Mankato Economic Development Corporation. I also represent the Greater Mankato Chamber of Commerce this evening. I don't know that what I want to do really is amplify some of the points that you've heard this evening. You saw some excellent data at the beginning of this evening about some of the commercial impact of Highway 14. And I think one of the things that is important is to understand the diversification of that economic portfolio. You know, beyond the agricultural impact, if you really think about Highway 14, think about it as a corridor of commerce. And it's really about the movement of a variety of things, movement of goods, the movement of people. About both of those facets that come together in a corridor of commerce. And if you really start to think a little bit further about it, think about the educational access that needs to occur. In southern Minnesota, in Mankato and North Mankato, you have two of the Minsky system's largest workhorses. The collection of South Central College and Minnesota State University Mankato together, outside of the metropolitan Minsky institutions, outside of that make up fully one-third of all of what Minsky does outside of the Twin Cities marketplace. So two of the biggest workforces in the educational system are sitting right here. Access to those institutions is imperative. It's imperative because communities and states that are going to be successful in the future with a new economy are those communities and states that are focused on a couple of things called people and places. It's going to be about communities that are attracted to talent, that can retain talent and keep it here. It's imperative that people that are part of these communities have access to the resources that they need, to the attributes that they need to be part of communities. The Greater Mankato Marketplace is the only regional center. It's not connected to other major regional centers and hubs by full four-lane highways. That's a critical aspect. In addition to education, it also amplifies the notion of healthcare. You have a healthcare presence, a regional healthcare facility that's here, facilities that's here, a regional healthcare center, from education as well as practical application. People need to be able to access that. This marketplace has been identified as a community that's one of the top 100 to raise your family in, your kids in. It's also recently been identified as one of the top 10 cities in the country to keep your eyes on as a place to retire. People need to be able to have access between these points. A couple of years ago, some statistical information that's rather interesting. A couple of years ago, the Initiative Foundation did some research about the economic impact of the Highway 14 corridor, this corridor of commerce. 72% of the region's top 25 employers were located along, are located along Highway 14. Of those 25, 18 of those companies employ more than 45,000 people, and that represents 88% of the labor force. And all six of the regional centers located along Highway 14 have experienced growth in the last decade. So these are growing regional marketplaces, and I would come to a point even further about the growth of the state of Minnesota and about these regional marketplaces. You've seen the data from the U.S. Census Bureau. We're going to grow as a state by more than a million people in the next 23 years. The folks that don't locate in the metropolitan statistical area, in the Minneapolis, St. Paul metroplex, which will be about 75% of those million, the other 250,000 are going to locate in or near regional centers. So it's imperative, again, that we have ways for folks to move between those regional centers to access those corridors of commerce. We're fully talking about anywhere between 25 and 50,000 people that will extend themselves upon a marketplace like the Mankato North Mankato Regional Center, that within only a couple of years will become the metropolitan statistical area, the fifth in the state of Minnesota. A good transportation system is imperative to not just the economic vitality of communities, but truly the community's vitality. We've got to figure out how to fix that system. And as we listen to all of this tonight, the challenge is, you can continue to hear these stories, we've got to figure out the way to fund it. We've got to figure out the way to get the dollars in the system to recover on this. I'm not standing here with those answers tonight. What I wanted to do this evening was just to amplify some of these points for you and give you a larger scope in terms of what this means to the regional marketplace. But I think we've got to figure out a way to get at these issues at home. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce.
Representative Gilmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kirk, one of the things I've heard you say here is that you wanted a four-lane highway or access to this regional center. You said that you really didn't have an answer for funding. Well, what are you thinking that you don't want to have?
That's the funding.
What piece of your toolbox are you not interested in achieving for funding?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm equipped to be able to say it, Stephen. Well, here's the aspect you should or shouldn't. I don't know what that full package looks like. Mayor Zellmer talked specifically about the burden that sits upon local taxpayers already and the options that are there. That distribution system that you have, the tools that you have available to us, I haven't studied that. So I don't know what that looks like. He eloquently spoke to that issue that there's an awful lot that we're trying to pull into that and have attempted to do, but there's only so much that we can do at a local level. There has been support in throughout the marketplace and others about tax gas increases. Now, that's an answer that's been talked about an awful lot. Is it the right answer? It hasn't been able to get the traction of it done. Maybe there's something completely innovative we haven't thought about yet. I don't know what those would be, but perhaps it's time we try to look differently at the image in a way we've never looked at before.
Well, again, I guess I'm just trying to get some clarification from you. As you know, the Minnesota Chamber has not been supportive of the gas tax above 5 cents, and they want a full bonding package. Where does the Mankato Chamber stand on that?
The Mankato Chamber last year took a position on that, and I believe they were supportive of that gas tax up to 10 cents.
That's very, very good to know.
That's a nice response. Thank you.
You want to give it a
thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to ask about the chamber too. If they were independent here or just doing what the Minnesota State Chamber told you to do.
No, I can tell you that this local marketplace responds to its community, not to any sort of direction from another from a marketplace like the Minnesota Chamber. We take that responsibility and make a decision that's in the best interest of our marketplace. And take that opportunity to make those decisions based on what our constituents and our businesses have.
Just to amplify on that, I agree with what Jonathan has said, but our chamber has always been pretty independent. It has worked with the state chamber and has created its own policy, its own legislative committee, and its own legislative platform.
You're
welcome.
Thank you,
Chairman.
Chairman Leader and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. I'm president of the Minnesota Public Transit Association. I represent 67 transit systems in Minnesota, in the metro area, in rural Minnesota, throughout our entire state.
And your name, please, for the record.
Tony Kelling from St. Cloud. I also have been involved in transit management 23 years with St. Cloud Metro Bus in our four city transit system in St. Cloud. Transportation services differ throughout our state, but we all have the same interest. It's mobility. Regardless of where you live, where you work, or where you travel, mobility is a key issue for all of us. Greater Minnesota Transit is an essential link to small towns, rural areas throughout Greater Minnesota. Many people have limited access to automobiles, and rural communities are spread across large areas and long distances. Many services require access to regional centers from these small rural areas. We need to have expanded and enhanced transit services that allow people in rural areas to connect to the regional centers. We need to invest in transit, and that equals investment in economic development. It allows people to live and work in their communities. It allows people to retire in their communities and remain there. Lack of reliable transit services is a barrier to getting work for a lot of people in rural Minnesota. It's also a barrier for people to get off of assistance, which essentially is funded through the government also. More and more seniors are needing to travel farther and farther distances to get to medical, dental, nutrition, appointments, and shopping. Without transit, mobility really leads to isolation in rural Minnesota. It also leads to a lower quality of life for many people. And actually, in my mother's case and in many other people's cases in rural Minnesota, it leads to assisted living, moving into regional centers, which actually ends up costing counties more and more as a result of the lack of investment that we have in keeping people in those rural communities. In 2001, MnDOT completed their transit plan for Greater Minnesota. And just in the last 6 years, we've fallen behind to the tune of where if we were to get back on track in the next 13 years, we'd have to spend a whopping $341 million to get that plan back on track. And that doesn't include capital costs for vehicles and facilities. In 2008 alone, in the bare bones budget bill that was passed for transportation, we're short $1.4 million in Greater Minnesota just to meet the current budgets that we have with MnDOT. So many systems out here are still trying to figure out, we don't really know what's going to happen in 2008. And actually we'll be hearing from our association and possibly from MnDOT too that there will be some requests for a supplemental appropriation. We're happy though for the metro area. We did a very good job there with an additional $20 million and the higher end of split for the metropolitan area. They're doing pretty good for the next 2 years. In fact, they have an increase of $49 million in funding in the metro area as a result of the bill that was passed. So we're in St. Cloud alone too. I mean, we're looking at service cuts, possibly fare increases. In fact, there's a fare increase coming up in November again. In Mankato, they have a $1.1 million budget in the Mankato system. They identified a year ago $280,000 in service that they wanted to put on the street that they would have their local share to do. I know they have done some night service here, but mostly geared around the campus of Mankato State University. In Greater Minnesota, just in summary, there's 66 of the 80 counties that are served.
that are non-metro counties. There's a great variety in how Greater Minnesota transportations are served. This year that we're finishing, there will be about 970,000 hours of service in Greater Minnesota and about 10 million passenger trips. Most services, though, in rural Minnesota, unlike the metro area, end in late afternoon or early evening. There's only 11 systems of the 67 systems in Minnesota that operate after 6 p.m. There's only a fourth of the systems in Minnesota that operate on Saturday in Greater Minnesota. And there's only 11 of the 67 systems that operate on Sunday. There are seven counties that have no service, and that transit plan for 2010 was anticipating having service in every county. There are seven counties that have city service only. A number of those counties that have no service or city service only are right in this regional area. So, I guess in summary, the gaps continue to increase, you know, as we go year to year without long-term funding. Mobility continues to decrease. I know Region 9 did a study and identified a number of gaps. It's very interesting, but their biggest gap is access to service in the evenings and weekends. And they identify some strategies to deal with that. And it all involves money. And their number one identified reason that they can't put these services in federal and state funding. So finally, I guess strengthening our transit access for mobility, for those that are needing to get to work, to jobs, to shopping, it has to become a priority and we need to fund it. A lot of the population is changing in the workforce too. In St. Cloud alone, we have requests for about $500,000 in service outside of our metro area that is actually in our taxing district that we can't serve. I don't mean to overlay the St. Cloud picture into this, but one of those companies is Stearns Manufacturing that manufactures life vests to report throughout the whole world. They have seven languages spoken in their plant, and they regularly use interpreters just to work with their workforce. So we have a changing workforce, we have changing demographics with our aging population, and we really need to address both the metro area and Greater Minnesota in stable funding for transit. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Mr. Gallen, thank you. You gave me a lead-in because Nicholls County is one of those seven counties that does not have a satellite transit system other than the Mankato system in St. Peter. What I'm hearing is folks want to retire and stay living in their homes, live on their farms. Didn't be able to get to the doctor and get to the store, so I'm glad that you pointed out. I also want to point out Representative Bedore here on my left is one of the big champions for rural transit and making sure MBS money comes in a fair percentage down out to Minnesota. So I want to note that in part because it's not always the metro and the suburbs versus rural Minnesota that's going to get transit.
Well, as an association, Representative Marl, we represent the entire state. And so there's always that challenge to have balance and keep everybody on the same page. But the last couple of years, that's become more and more difficult because as the pot has shrunk, you have people beginning to fight over the shrinking pot. Mm-hmm. It's not enough for the one or the whole. So that needs to be fixed.
Representative Nelson.
I guess this just impeded my earlier questions or the earlier testifier that I was glad to see that I'm hearing it's not just the metro area that's trying to suck up all transit, that the rural area does need and want transit out here. We keep hearing from some transit folks that it's only the metro area that needs transit and we're the only ones that are going for it. And I also support metro or rural transit because, like you say, as our population gets older, there's going to be more and more of a need for some sort of public transit system as people no longer are able to drive. So I'm glad to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. I think it's pretty well accepted that there's a bill, it's a transportation bill that includes highways and transit, you know that, so you can tell Dave that too. Mr. Goodrich?
Thank you.
We got a man that's
Well, good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Goodrich. I'm president of R&E Enterprises, current board member of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and a past chairman of the Minnesota Trucking Association. R&E Enterprises is a very diverse trucking company. This would haul general freight over the road. We also haul construction materials, building state highways, business constructions for expansion, and we also do quite a bit of township road gravel. So transportation is funding is a big part of our business. We also spread ag lime throughout the southern half of Minnesota, western Dakotas, and northern Iowa. We employ between 25 and 30 people, depending on the time of the year. Our message tonight is to fund the highway system with tools we currently have in place. It has been and will be in the future a very equitable source of funding for transportation. New means of collecting taxes cost a lot of money for us to track and to collect. For example, one of my favorite ones is the state of Kansas. In Kansas today, when my trucks drive through there, we have to file and pay a personal property tax in the state of Kansas for the use of their roads. That cost me last year about $500 to pay that fee. It cost me over $400 to fill out the paperwork. That's why I suggest that we use current methods to pay for those funds instead of asking us to file additional administrative paperwork. My business requires roads that are free of congestion and potholes to make safe on on-time deliveries. Creating additional lanes to alleviate congestion will do just that by reducing accidents and emissions created in stop-and-go traffic. Keeping the roads we have properly maintained means that I keep my trucks on the road and out of the maintenance shops. I know that more lanes and smooth roads would require more money. However, we need to be very careful how we fund those needs. As my drivers travel around the country, they have witnessed an alarming trend. Public officials in other states are choosing to privatize and toll existing publicly funded roadways in the name of generating additional dollars for roads. Mr. Chair and members of this committee, there are five reasons privatization and tolling existing public infrastructures are not appropriate to raise highway revenue. First, the buyer is generally foreign when roads are sold or leased to private entities. Second, these sales or leases generally occur to satisfy debt relief or spending, not to administer additional roads. Third, many of the facilities under construction for private takeover are among the most critical links for our freight and military logistic chains. They are also important commuter and tourist arteries. Will the private operators act in the public interest, even if it cuts into their bottom line? Given that this responsibility to their shareholders, it would seem unlikely. Fourth, administering a tollway costs between 25 and 30% of the revenue it generates. I'll give you two examples of what we face driving towards the East Coast. In the state of Indiana and Ohio, it costs in Ohio $33.50 in tolls to use I-80 and drive 239 miles. That's 14 cents per mile for my truck. In the state of Indiana, it costs $26.50 to drive 157 miles. That's 17 cents per mile, plus we pay the fuel tax of about, in Indiana, 27 cents per gallon. Finally, existing publicly financed roads are already paid for and effectively making tolling double taxation. Truckers are willing to pay their fair share. In fact, we do that more and more. Trucks represent only 4% of the registered vehicles and 8% of the total vehicle miles traveled, but pay 35% of the total state and federal highway revenues. Having said that, we understand that the increasing demand on our infrastructure must be dealt with. Highway needs can be met using the existing tried and true collection tools, such as fuel taxes, registration taxes, and motor vehicle sales tax. These taxes, unlike alternative roads revenue schemes, provide little opportunity for evasion, reflect highway and vehicle use, and are inexpensive to administer, and do not create impediment to interstate commerce. This legislative session in 2008 brings with it a great deal of pressure to pass a substantial bill for roads and bridges. I encourage you to use the tried and true tools already in place and in doing so, avoid placing our infrastructure and businesses in jeopardy. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for that excellent testimony. That's something we haven't heard that we're fully aware of about privatization. The committee is aware of that, and we certainly don't want to see it happen. Nothing important.
Thank you. I've heard you speak, I think, at the Mississippi Valley Conference. Did you speak about workforce issues facing the trucking industry at a MnDOT conference this summer?
No, I didn't speak of that, but we've talked about it. One of the things that's very trying in the trucking industry is finding drivers to drive trucks. By the year 2011, they are predicting that we will be 110,000 truck drivers short. So that's one of the big things that we need to work on within the state of Minnesota. That's correct.
And then just a question about the need to idle the truck when you have your mandatory rest periods. My understanding is in Minnesota we have to probably fix something that a trucker can only be at a rest area for 8 hours, but really you have a required rest period of 10 hours.
That's correct.
And so I think that's something we should be fixing early in the session.
That's correct. That is a very prying thing, is that truck drivers are required to take a 10-hour break. There's no exception to that, and if they're parked in a rest area today in the state of Minnesota, by law, they can only remain there for 8 hours. So that means somebody's going to have to break the law in order to either stay there for 2 additional hours or leave and not show it as doing that. So that is a major problem we have, and also the ability for our trucks to have an alternative means of keeping the truck drivers warm or cool, whichever it is necessary and safe, as these drivers must live in that facility, and if it's hot, it's, I don't know how to explain, it's like being in a tin can. It can get extremely hot or extremely cold very quickly. So it's a very big thing as we find some good alternatives. And there's some new technology coming down the pipe within the next few years that we will rectify the problem emissions-free.
Just a quick follow-up on that. I know some states are looking at putting like some sort of electrical plug-in at the rest area so that you could plug in some way, some generation to keep warm instead of having to run the engine all night. I'm just wondering how many truckers are putting things like that in their vehicles and whether we should be looking at putting that kind of plug-in facility at our rest areas or if it's a little early to be looking at that.
I think you will find that the technology out there today, if we could find a way to help pay for these additional things, there are better alternatives than trying to buy electricity at a rest area.
Mm-hmm.
There are better ways to keep the driver warm or cool, whatever is necessary, with technology. What we need is funding to do that. We're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $6,000 per truck to keep that driver warm or cool. And that is probably the biggest drawback to do that is already in the state of Minnesota, we have numerous cities that have no idling. In other words, if you go to the, no one's here, I hope, to the city of Owatonna, for an example, you cannot idle a truck in the city of Owatonna. That's just one of the rules that have been established. There are other cities, numerous ones in the state of Minnesota, where a truck cannot idle, so the driver cannot stay warm or he cannot stay cool without breaking the law.
Thank you.
Do you have a separate limitation like they do in the military?
That is one of the alternatives, but there are some new battery-powered units that are coming down the pipe that will be no emissions, and that's been the problem. The state of California, for an example, truckers are now getting tickets for violating a engine running because they are using an auxiliary power unit to keep themselves warm or cool, and that breaks California law.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goodrich.
Thank you. One other thing, we will hand out tonight a publication for you to take home. I know you have nothing to do but read a little bit. It was put out by the American Trucking Association, and Jeremy is here tonight, and he will pass one on mouth to each one of you. Thank you.
Mr. Torkelson, Farm Bureau, Minnesota Farm Bureau.
Good evening. My name is Paul Torkelson, and I serve as Vice President of the Farm Bureau. I own and operate a corn, soybean, and hog farm near St. James in Watonwan County. Thank you, Chair, Leader, for and the committee for coming to Southwestern Minnesota. We appreciate your coming out here. That's really appreciated that you would come out and see us here on our own turf. I will abbreviate my remarks in the interest of time. Much of what I was going to cover was very adequately covered by Mr. Swanson and Mr. Christensen regarding the change in agriculture in Southwestern Minnesota and how we need the transportation system more than ever for modern agriculture. And Mr. Chrysler from the pork producers also covered much of the topics that I was going to cover. So I'll skip over that. I will emphasize that agriculture in Minnesota does need access to a global transportation system, and those internodal points that were talked about are very critical so that we can move our production out of the state and onto the international markets. I will just cover some of the points that Farm Bureau does support in relation to transportation. Farm Bureau supports building or upgrading paved county roads to 10-ton capacity. These roads are critical in the movement of farm inputs and the commodities we produce. The growing renewable fuels industry has increased the need for rail lines. Much of the ethanol is shipped by rail. We encourage the committee to consider this increasing rail demand as you look at the railroad piece of the transportation infrastructure. Farm Bureau does support an increase in the state gas tax to fund transportation. Farm Bureau supports investments in various ports that serve Minnesota and the Mississippi River and Lake Superior. These ports are a vital link to moving agricultural commodities from Minnesota to national and global markets. In addition, many agricultural inputs are shipped to these ports. Well-maintained ports are another critical piece of our transportation infrastructure. I feel a little bit like the poster child for the first presentation you had tonight. I own and operate a farm, and I also own and operate large trucks. Just about a year ago, I constructed a hog finishing facility. I was fortunate enough to be able to site that facility on a state highway, which is a great benefit because I don't have to worry so much about load restrictions, but I have to say that the MnDOT people are doing their job. I had to get a permit to construct a driveway for that hog facility, and that included a 100-foot culvert and a nice wide top on that driveway so the trucks can get in and out safely, because the state highway in that particular area, State Highway 4, has very narrow shoulders. So a very wide driveway was required because of the very narrow shoulder on the road. And I would, from personal experience, also like to reiterate the need for wide shoulders on these railroads as we move our agriculture equipment up and down the roads. These narrow shoulders are really difficult to deal with because of the width of the equipment that we use. Meeting transportation needs for Minnesota farmers is a big task for this committee. On behalf of the Farm Bureau, I want to thank you for conducting today's hearing to learn more about our transportation needs. We look forward to working with members of this committee and your colleagues in developing and implementing solutions that will maintain the integrity of Minnesota's transportation system. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Other questions, Mr. Torkelson? Thank you for your testimony. I recognize you, but I'm just covering the floor, so we appreciate you condensing it. Mr. Schauber? Mayor Corbin.
Good evening, I'm the Mayor of Corbin, Bob Schiebert. I'm here representing Region 9 Commission. I'm a Region 9 Commission. I'm here representing the transportation issues for Region 9. Region 9 is comprised of 9 counties in southern Minnesota within a 50-mile radius of Mankato. Region 9 interest in transportation ranges from township roads and state highways to transit, economic impact enhancements. The Commission is focused on maximizing the use of all transportation modes for movement of people and goods in the safest, most expedient, and most efficient way possible. I will use my remaining time to highlight key transportation issues important to Region 9 area. Preservation, which includes seal coating and overlay and new pavement on highways, ensuring longer road life, smoother rides, capacity for heavy commercial vehicles, is a low-cost mechanism engineers use to maximize return on investment in our infrastructure. unfortunately, our country, city and state engineers are facing limited funding and in need of more resources to keep transportation network fully functional. Expansion and growth of areas, corridors connecting major origins and destinations, construction, expansion, new roads, is necessary to meet the increase of heavy demand placed on these roads by communities and industries. To use Truck Highway 14 as an example, expansion to four lanes is needed to support the high number of travelers, create safer passing situations, migrate dangerous intersections, handle increased number of commercial vehicles, and add economic value to the region. Normally, there are other similar examples such as Highway 169, 15, 60, and 19, but 14 is dear to my heart. Transit is usually viewed in the urban perspective of destiny and moving masses of people. However, in rural areas, transit is very important and varied for different reasons. Many of our citizens' needs become very much necessary when they get older. Inability of people to afford traditional transportation, physical limitations, aging, and so on create a necessary public transportation that will adequately transport people to and from their destinations. People need this transportation option for such important tasks as grocery shopping, medical appointments, employment, general purpose travel. Only five of the nine regions in Region 9 have citywide transportation available to their citizens. Economic growth, transportation investment can support economic growth in several ways. I will highlight two. Adequate highway, rail, and air services are necessary for determining location of new expansions of companies. Transportation is a large consideration of private sector bottom line where and when they locate. State of the art transportation infrastructure will be equally economic role. Roads must be able to carry heavy loads to support regional and local economics. In rural areas such as the local economy is derived from acres and acres of farmland that depend on highway infrastructure to get products to market. A network of roads at the local level, which is built to modern waste standards, is necessary to reduce the number of duration of trips and farmers must make. Further growth in the biofuel industry has created a major shift in the transportation dynamics of ag business. This change is resulting in exponential growth in the heavy commercial vehicles use of our state highways. Keeping people safe as they travel our roads must be a top priority. Simple but sometimes expensive investments make our roads safer. Satisfactory meeting transportation needs in this area and state both currently and in the future require ongoing investment in excess of what's been available in recent years. We respectfully request the legislature and government to develop a comprehensive funding package that will bring central and overdue funding to the area of transportation. We ask to pass the state transportation funding package in 2008, which includes the following: a state gas tax increase of 10 cents per gallon, which would put Minnesota in line with other states and our level of investment over 20 years. Indexing the gas tax so that buying power will always be maintained in the level it was when it was passed. Funding important projects quickly through the bonding bill. Large projects in this area include Highway 14 from Mankato to Nuam. Improvements and completion of a Highway 60 corridor, development transit for four counties, and preservation of Highway Interstate 90. That's what Region 9 stands for, and what they're looking for in the transportation budget. They're very big on transporting and trying to get people from there to there when they get older and that kind of stuff. So Region 9 is very big on transportation and many, many different modes instead of just a Highway 14 and that, and rural areas and that. That's just for Region 9, but I got a couple comments to make too, because I won't repeat what Gary the Mayor of North Vancouver said. He did a wonderful job on explaining 14. We live on 14. I live on 14 in the city of Cortland. So if you go from Mankato to New Orleans, you'll see that wonderful town of Cortland. And what we have is we have two major intersections in town that are very disastrous. We haven't had no life-changing accidents yet there and no deaths. But if you go there at any time almost, you can see long stretches of black marks in the highway where people had to make quick stops. And the highway department doesn't seem that they can do anything about it because the traffic is speeding at 35 now at one location and 45 at the other. But one of these days, it's just a matter of time when something major is going to happen. So we could use some help, and we're not trying to steal from the St. Paul and that. We just like to be equal. We like to get equal treatment or fair treatment in that. So I've sat in traffic in St. Paul, Minneapolis. I've been in the bottlenecks and that, so I understand their need, but I don't do it daily, but I drive 14 daily. So appreciate all the help you guys can give, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But Region 9 is very, very big on transportation, so we appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Payman?
Thank you. My name is Kevin Payman. I'm the county engineer with Martin County. I just wanted to share some of the problems we've had paying for our roads, and I'm trying to be very abbreviated with it. From 2004 to 2007, our state allotment has gone from about 3.25 million down to 3.15 million, so that's just going to decrease in about $100,000 in our state aid. And as you're well aware, in that same period of time, we've seen roughly 10% increases in our cost of the business. Being a county, seeing a great study, we have 200 million gallon ethanol plants that are being built right now inside of our county. We also have about 700,000 hogs inside of our county, so the most important thing we have for economic development is our infrastructure. So our commissioners have felt strongly that we want to try to keep up. But as you know, property tax is the only way we've had to do that. So from 2004 to 2007, we've increased our property taxes almost $40,000, or 40% for the road and bridge levy, which seems like a decent amount to do to taxpayers. But if you figure that in with our state aid and the decrease we've had in state aid, that's almost 10% a year average that we've had an increase is actually mounted to only about a 2% total budget increase. When you figure the extra cost of the business, we've lost ground. We've also, our 2008 levy, we're proposing about a $450,000 increase, or about 27% increase. So if you look at from that 2004 that I mentioned earlier, our state aid went from about $3.25 million down to $3.15 million, a decrease. Our local levy in that same time frame is going to go from about $1.25 million up to almost $2.5 million. And we've had drastic increases in our local levy. And with that, even with that amount of levy increases, we've had to cut services. We've had two positions of 27 that we have not filled. So it's just, as you're all aware, it's a dire situation for us. We also had to bond $3 million in those six to pay for construction that just couldn't get done on roads that we're not going to hold up. We also are going to be paying bonding services for the next 15 years on that debt that's going to be passed on to the taxpayers. And in Martin County, at least this year, it's gotten to the point that it's not only affected the highway department's local levy, it's affected every department inside the county, because when our biggest budget is the highway department, we're looking at these major increases. Our board took the approach that almost every other department had to have zero increases to offset the huge increases in the highway department. So I just wanted to relay the effort that some of our colleagues are dealing with and trying to pay for our roads when they're so important to us, instead of having the options of a property tax. So just thank you for your past efforts and your future efforts.
Thank you very much for your comments. Any questions? Representative
Parker? Well, just real quick, I was wondering if you knew that the vetoed bill would have brought $11 million to Martin County between fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 2017, starting with $350,000 more in 08 than what you're getting now. And I forget what you said, your property tax levy is going up. How many hundred thousand is it going up?
This year it's going to go up. It's been going up about 100,000 a year, but this year it's going to go up about 450,000 in from 07 to 08. And that's just to try to break even.
So maybe if we would have been able to send you that $350,000 in the transportation bill, that might have kept your levy down a little.
Definitely would have. You know, and we talked about that, and our board passed a resolution by voting unanimously to support that bill. You know, the main reason I talked to this, decided to bring these numbers here, you know, my representative and senator both voted against the bill in the past,
and both argued with me, and we talked about this funding issue, and they both came to our board meeting probably a month ago, and we gave them some of these numbers in a little longer format, and it went a few times where they couldn't really argue with us, and they saw the problem we were in and what it was doing to our property taxes. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Pam Detterman, and I am the, I'm representing a very different perspective from what you've been hearing all evening, and I'm actually not here to ask you for money, which might be a bit refreshing. I am the director of a faith-based nonprofit organization based here in Mankato, and our services extend both to Blue Earth and to Nicollet County. And I'm here tonight, I think, representing about 250 very ordinary people who want to be a part of the transportation solution, and those are volunteer drivers. In the past year, they provided 25,037 rides to older adults, people that have disabilities, and also to people who are working to get themselves out of poverty by providing transportation to work. They will start tomorrow morning at 4:30 a.m. Taking people to their jobs and dropping their kids off at daycare. And the last ride tonight will probably be about 11:15, taking somebody to a third shift job, and the driver the next morning will pick them up and come home. And earlier on, Mark Anderson spoke about, you know, the number of people that are certified as disabled, and I do believe that we are definitely a part of that solution too, because of the 861 passengers that we provided rides for last year. Probably about 700 of those folks would have qualified to ride on that bus if the public transportation were able to alleviate from fixed route systems and not be bound to, you know, running between 8 and 5 on Mondays through Fridays, because human need does not know 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. And what I'm here to talk about, though, today is, I think, three points that I want to make that I think that are problems that I think that are within our power as ordinary Minnesotans to make a difference about. And if I come here and I listen to these numbers and listen to you talk, I feel pretty powerless, and I would imagine that you might just feel even more than that, having to listen to this every place you go. But I do think that there are some solutions that we could maybe go away here from. And the first one, I think, what I would like you to do would be to go to MnDOT and to encourage them to work outside of the box. And with that said, I would also share the good news that Vine Safe in Action recently was the recipient of some federal funds from the new Freedom Act that were filtered through MnDOT to local communities that were able to propose some viable solutions to solve transportation problems for people who were not quite old enough, not quite poor enough, or not quite disabled enough to fall into the guidelines of other programs. But by and large, those are a lot of your constituents and my neighbors. And with this grant, we will be able to develop a system of mobility management where one of our staff members will be charged to look at, let's find solutions that already exist, and let's create relationships to move people from place to place into medical hubs and other places and get them the rides that they need. And in rural Minnesota, you know, there's some communities where people can't buy their medications because there's no pharmacies. To put it quite frankly, there's places where in rural Minnesota where you can't go to the store and buy underwear. You have to go into bigger communities to do that. And we want to be a part of that solution to help to keep people living in their hometowns and places like that. So what I would like you to do would be to go back to MnDOT and encourage them to look to see more ways that they can partner with nonprofits, with organizations that are doing the work. An example that I would like to bring tonight that was a very frustrating example to us that could have really bettered our project was through another program that MnDOT administers called the 5310 program, where local communities pay 20% towards the cost of a handicapped bus. And that was in our plan to do that, but because of MnDOT's guidelines, I missed the deadline because they said that a month before the grant was sent in, we had to post our intent in the local newspaper. And even though the grant wasn't going to be funded for 6 to 7 months after they received it, they would not bend on that rule. And quite frankly, when you work for a nonprofit, you work 60 hours a week, and that just wasn't in my schedule. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people will not be able to have access to the transportation because of that guideline that really still doesn't make any sense to me as a taxpayer or a person working to make life better for others. The other thing that I think that you can do, again, it probably wouldn't cost a lot of money, but I hear I'm talking to the rural legislators and representatives, is to go back to your own communities and to your districts and into your counties. I'm probably not just talking to you, but talking to all of you that are in this room that are from rural counties. And look and challenge them to look at the what they can out of local dollars put in towards forming a coordinated transportation system in the rural area. And here I really want to commend Blue Earth County Human Services, who for the last 7 years has partnered with us in a very solid public-private partnership by giving us a block grant each year to spend in the way that makes sense to provide transportation for our elders. And it's working, and there are resources to be able to do that. But it's going to mean helping people to set aside their silos and say, this is only for us and for our county, and our public transit system, if we have one, can't cross the county line. We have to stop thinking in terms of just counties and think about ways that we can meet the needs of our people in the rural areas. And the third thing that I think you can do is to work to find solutions, probably with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, in looking to provide insurance for volunteers so that it does become more of a safe option for people to volunteer. I also network very closely with faith-based organizations all around the state, and we all feel that there are plenty of volunteer drivers out there who are willing to be a part of the solution if they can be guaranteed that it's safe, and if possibly there's some reimbursement, if there's people putting some gas in their tank so that they can do that driving. And I think that it's a very hopeful thing that I would like to propose to you tonight to look to see how you can help us to make that happen. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Helfershin.
I believe it's left, but just for the record, his expertise and interest is in commuter rail. So, everybody is interested in talking to him.
Jack Golders?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, I'll be here for about 90 seconds. Jack Golders, County Commissioner Nicola County. I want to thank you folks for being here tonight. I want to thank the folks who have testified here tonight. And I want to say that I don't think Minnesota Transportation has a voice. I think our transportation system is sick, and it's not getting any treatment. And like a cancer growing in your body, Minnesota's transportation is not healthy, and there is one person unwilling to be a doctor. You know who you're talking about. In May of 2005, our county board passed a resolution urging that person we're talking about and the state legislature to increase transportation funding. The legislature listened, that person did. At that time, gas prices were $1.95. Again, you look at today's prices, $2.85 to $3.15 to whatever it's going to be, state motorists did not see any benefit of that gas tax, of that higher gas tax, or higher prices of gas. We didn't see a dime. We didn't see a nickel. We didn't see a penny. Convince him to listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We keep trying.
You know, it was really disappointing, Representative, that when the moment came, when the opportunity was there, when the bridge fell down, we heard the governor talking about we got to fix it. And then another catastrophe came, and I know you had an answer to that. But folks, we listen to, as commissioner, I listen to my county engineer, who's here tonight. And they know what they're talking about. They're like doctors for our roads. So we try to urge him to work with him and make him change his mind. I'm frankly hoping that he gets elected as vice president so we can get him the hell out of here.
Everybody's time spoke. There's just one person on the list. He didn't.
Who was it?
And Mike Wanker was
speaking. I can't imagine that.